Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Owens Corning of New England, helping homeowners create living space using the Owens Corning basement finishing system for over 20 years. More information at ocboston.com. And North Shore Music Theater. Audiences can experience the true story and musical journey of Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons. Jersey Boys comes to Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater May 7th through May 19th. Tickets at nsmt.org.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, go back home. Those are the words Donald Trump used to attack the four diverse and progressive Democratic congresswomen. He tweeted that they should go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came. This racist language is right up there with his S-hole nation's comments and with his Obama birther obsession. While Joe Biden can't break away from comments he's made about busing and segregationists, how is Trump getting away with this? On today's Politics Roundup, we talk about this and more. Then it's all about Bob. TV authority Bob Thompson joins us to mark the 20th anniversary of SpongeBob SquarePants and to talk about how the New York Times found thousands of paintings by PBS own Bob Ross. And at noon, Andrew Cabral is here for another edition of Law and Order with a preview of Mueller's testimony next week. And if Democrats who want to impeach will find what they need. All that is next on Boston Public Radio. Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. Jim Browdy has the day off, and here with us to pick up the slack is Sue O'Connell.
That's one way of calling Jim, huh? That's
Thank
picking
you.
Up the slack, baby.
Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows, publisher of Bay Windows, co-publisher, I should say, of Bay Windows.
Yeah, don't get Jeff mad.
Anything else I should add to that?
And at NECN, as in, I don't know what my title is yet, but you can watch me on the TV.
Okay, she's at NECN doing something. Okay, and here with us in Studio 3 to talk about the latest political headlines from the White House, the State House, are Jeff Diehl and Steve Kerrigan. Jeff Diehl is a Republican, former state representative. Steve Kerrigan is a Democratic strategist. Jeff Diehl also ran the Trump campaign in Massachusetts. Steve is also the CEO of the Edward M. Kennedy Community Health Center. Jeff and Steve, thank you very much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Our pleasure.
So I said to Jeff, I don't mean to be picking on you, Jeff, but it has been a tough couple of days for the president.
Tough couple of years.
Okay. As you know, the president most recently told that four congresswomen, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from the Bronx, Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, Ayanna Pressley, our own Ayanna Pressley here from Massachusetts, and Ilhan Omar.
A.K.A. The Squad, right?
The Squad, yes.
Not from, to be confused with Taylor Swift's squad.
Exactly. Much
That's
different
right.
squad.
From Minnesota, that and that they all should get out of here, that they're the Democratic progressive congresswoman originally come. This is his tweet from countries whose governments are a complete and total catastrophe, the worst, most corrupt, inept anywhere in the world if they have a functioning government at all, that they should get out of here, go back to the countries they came from and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came, et cetera. So what do you make of this, Jeff?
Well, look, I mean, first of all, I think this comes on the heels of a couple bad, I'm not sure if it's days or weeks for the Democratic caucus as far as Nancy Pelosi.
What do you think about the tweet?
No, and I'm getting there. And that is that obviously there was sort of internal dissent with Pelosi and the squad. And I think what Trump was doing was trying to further exacerbate, you know, that situation.
And yet he did what I don't think he hoped to. He
right.
united the Democratic caucus with
but
his
what you,
racist.
What do you think about the tweet? Do you think the tweet was racist? Do you think the president's intent and point of view on this is racism? Because, I mean, I lived in an immigrant community my whole life in Revere and now in Boston. And the only time I've ever heard anybody say to somebody, go back to where you came from, it's usually been a person of color, and it's usually been from a bigoted, racist viewpoint. So do you think President Trump's tweet was racist?
I don't necessarily think it's that type of intent. And, well, I mean, let me put it this way. A lot of times you'll also hear a similar kind of thing of, if you don't like it, leave. That kind of a thing. I think that's really what he was – more of what he was saying. And what his point was generally and broadly – I mean, I certainly can't speak for him because I would never put a tweet out like this. But I think what he was trying to say was, look, you've been very openly critical of the way immigration or the borders have been handled, and you're criticizing this country in numerous ways, whether it's the economy, law enforcement – if you, you know, if you don't like it, why are you here?
Because to your point about unifying the Democrats, I go one day from thinking that Nancy Pelosi is not, you know, isn't doing a good job wrangling this progressive front. And then today I wake up and think she was just totally baiting the president.
Hold on for a second. Yeah. I think we have to establish here that this is a racist tweet.
Yes.
I don't think there's any question about that. The backstory doesn't really matter to me. It's a racist tweet. News organizations are having trouble, actually. I was surprised calling it a racist tweet. But to tell a bunch of people of color to go back where they came from is a racist tweet. And so we don't have any Republicans criticizing him, not even Mitt Romney.
Will you be that Republican? Will you be the Republican who says it was a racist tweet? I'm against that thought to look at an American citizen and tell them to go back where they came from.
So that is why I've had a problem for a long time with the constant use of the word racism. And I mean, if you want to say
I've had a trouble with the constant use of racism by this president and his administration.
Fair enough. But what I'm saying is, why isn't it not defined as bigotry or xenophobia? Let's just get more accurate about it rather than just try to say it's always racism. I mean, when you're talking about people from other countries, that's not a race. I just still don't understand.
He's talking about someone from Dorchester and telling her to go back to where she came from.
Someone born in Cincinnati, Ohio.
I mean, he wouldn't have been saying that if it was Tim Ryan because he is a white privileged.
I would just bet $1 million that Ayanna Pressley's ancestors have been here longer than President Trump's ancestors.
Well, and that inaccuracy is ridiculous. I mean, why would you say go back to a country when three of the four certainly were not here? By the way, I mean, again, we're talking about very open critics of the way immigration is being handled by this president. You know, I think Ilhan Omar had recently said that we're treating dogs better in this country than the human beings.
Well, frankly, we are.
My dog had a great weekend. And my dog went to the vet, went to the beach, to the dog park.
Was Ilhan Omar treated like a dog when she immigrated here? She followed laws and procedure.
That's not what she was talking about. She wasn't saying when she immigrated here. She's saying right now on the border, we are treating people.
Not even on the border. We all saw pictures on Friday night. And I got to say, when I saw the pictures of those men cramped into that room with the vice president, Lindsey Graham, standing next to him, I was ashamed of my country. This is the United States of America. But anyway, I think...
What is the solution, though? What is the solution being offered by critics?
Well, there's a lot... First of all...
There's a lot of solutions
being
offered.
He could hire a lot more judges. Yeah. He could stop these ridiculous attacks.
Ted Cruz said that a year ago. Let's get more judges on the border.
No, but this administration is the one who hires them. Yeah. The Department of Homeland Security and the Justice Department hire them.
Homeland Security that we would get rid of under Elizabeth Warren,
But we're under this administration now, Jeff. We're not under that one. We're under this one.
But that's the solution being offered. Just get rid of the law enforcement agencies that would try to fix this.
We've got to have a little order here in the room. I think the three of the four of us would agree that this is a racist tweet. Jeff doesn't, and that's your prerogative. But from a political perspective, Mr. Democrat over there, Steve Kerrigan,
thank you. Proud
appealing
label.
To white resentment can work. And we have 45% of Americans who think that Donald Trump is doing a good job. So I guess that means that many people and white voters think that this is okay.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I was disappointed, disgusted by it. Surprise is probably not the word I would use, because since day one, since his American Carnage inaugural address, where he chose rather than unite the country, particularly a president who didn't win the majority of the votes, rather than unite the country around some shared ideals and moving the country forward, he chose to stick with that 42% of his base. And he is hoping that'll ride him to victory. I am hoping that the rest of the American people, and frankly, those who decided to, you know, they didn't want the Hillary Clinton model of reform or whatever that was, or the old way of doing things, they wanted to burn the house down. My hope is that they're watching America burn and realizing they've got to come back and that they're going to vote for a Democrat in November 2020, because I frankly think he has only been banking on racism, misogyny, division, xenophobia, whatever it is, to divide our country more, because he thinks that that's going to get disenfranchised poor white people to be more engaged in his campaign. And I'm betting, frankly, on those families and people who, by the way, I grew up with a lot of lunch pail Democrats and lunch pail, you know, Reagan Democrats who likely voted for Donald Trump, who are not going to do it in 2020.
Steve, if you were magically in charge of the Democratic Party and Nancy Pelosi and in charge of the DNC, would you be talking about what to do regarding the impeachment path, what to do around the reelection or taking back the White House. A lot of people are presenting this as a binary. It's like either go impeachment or you work on taking back the White House. Do you think both can be done? And
yes.
is it important to do both?
Well, look, the impeachment process, as I've said many times on this show and elsewhere, is a political decision for the Congress of the United States to make. Yes, based on the law and whether or not the president committed crimes. And frankly, Robert Mueller said it very clearly, I thought, that, in essence, were that memo from the Office of Legal Counsel not there, the president likely would have been indicted for obstruction of justice. So there are members of Congress who, rightly or wrongly so, feel they have a path to go down to explore whether or not the president should be impeached. Because let's be very clear, like, his number one goal for reelection is that 4-year term, not to serve 4 more years as president, but because all of the statute of limitations will run out in those 4 years, and then he can skate scot-free from all the crimes that he and his family have committed over the last several years. And so I think we have an obligation to pursue that, but we have a greater obligation to the country to make sure that these 24 candidates, however many there are now, have an opportunity to openly debate and discuss who's going to be the next president of the United States and what our values and beliefs are.
So, Jeff, I mentioned before that we saw these horrible pictures on Friday night, which made me embarrassed, ashamed to be an American. But we saw Vice President Pence and Lindsey Graham basically say that things were okay. In fairness to the vice president, he also went to another newly built shelter that was for 1,000 people, and they had 800 people. I guess my question is, the president was able to declare an emergency for the border wall. We do have the $4.8 billion pass now that can bring more shelters and toothbrushes and soap and stuff. If things are that bad, which I think they look pretty bad to me with those men, why can't we just have the National Guard go in or somebody go in and just build some more damn places for these people to stay if we're not going to have enough asylum judges, which we don't, or we're not going to do the so-called catch and release thing, which we did under Barack Obama?
Yeah, I think any effort to expand the humanitarian effort to make sure we treat people humanely, I don't know why there's a feeling that there would be an objection towards that. I'm not sure who is saying don't try to treat them more humanely.
Well, the president could do it. He could do it today, right now.
But
he's the president.
I think also there's always been the debate that when we try to fix immigration, we don't also look at a stronger border wall. And he's been rejected constantly again on any efforts to fund a way in which we don't incentivize people to cross illegally. Come in like Ilhan Omar, do
but
it the right legal way.
Some of these people haven't crossed illegally. Some of these people are presenting that, you know, I keep rereading what the government says is legal when coming into the United States and asking for asylum. It doesn't matter what your status is to ask for asylum. You can be in the country illegally for 5 years and ask for asylum. You don't have to present yourself at a border, at a portal, at a passage through to ask for asylum.
Sue, let me ask a realistic question.
Yeah.
Do you think everybody asking for asylum is truly...
No, of course not, but they deserve...
Okay.
No, not at all. There's a process, and that during the Obama administration, Secretary of State John Kerry was sent to Central America to set up a pre-vetting opportunity so that you could stop people from coming in. The issue is that we have laws. We're not changing the laws, yet it doesn't seem, Steve, that we're obeying the laws when it comes to what we do when people say they're seeking asylum or come into the country.
Well, it's clear we have a crisis, as Marjorie's talking about. The Democratic Party or people, leaders in Congress from the Democratic Party, were not saying we even had a crisis a year ago. There is no crisis at the border.
Yeah, but this isn't a year ago anymore. And as Marjorie said, the president has border wall funding. He declared a national emergency. He's bringing in, rightly or wrongly, billions of dollars from military construction to the border to do this stuff. And yes, there's a lot of problems with immigration, which is why Democrats and Republicans back in the day when they had bipartisanship worked on immigration reform, comprehensive reform, which the president doesn't really want to do. This is the president who can decide all these things. He can deploy those resources.
You say he doesn't want to do it.
Had House and Senate for 2 years, and he got the Affordable Care Act, which has helped 20 million people go off of the unenrolled.
And I frankly
think that's the best legacy a president's going to have
Trump
since
FDR.
Trump had
House and Senate for 2 years. It's not as
easy
as people
think. But President Trump could pass an emergency executive order saying there is a crisis at the border and send FEMA. He could send the National Guard, and they could set up tents. They could also ask for volunteers from the ACLU and other organizations to help vet the seekers and decide if they're going to let them go with bracelets on to come back to court cases. I mean, these are things that can be done with the president's swipe of a pen.
And he has already signed declared a national emergency, which gives him broad sweeping power. He can do that stuff today. And he, and only he, can do that stuff today. But to blame the Democratic Party is a lot easier than actually doing it.
You know what a lot of people do think? That a lot of people, Ayanna Pressley said this, the congresswoman, has said that she thinks that the cruelty is a strategy. You think it is?
I'm sorry, the which?
The cruelty is a strategy. That the idea of separating children from their parents and having these men shoved into this cage where they didn't have beds and no room to lie down is a strategy. You think that's true?
I don't think that's true. To be honest with you, I think this crisis has escalated at such a rapid rate that there's been an attempt to try to handle all the people and modify the laws, like not separating children from families when, you know, that was clearly, with a Time magazine cover, hit a flashpoint, and then there was the Trump changed. Tried to make it so that we changed the regulations so they could stay with their families. I mean, Wayfair here in Massachusetts wouldn't even set beds when they were purchased to make at least some sort of comfort at the border level for political reasons. So it seems like nobody wants to work with
anybody. The president can just have the Army Corps of Engineers build these things, and they build bridges in 2 hours. I would just say, on your cruelty as a part of the plan, look, he scared countless people all across the country in 10 major cities for the last week and a half saying there were going to be raids. Can you imagine what these families did and what they went through? They raided in New York City and not the other 9 cities. His entire plan is to lead by fear. That's what he does. That's why he wanted the tanks next to him and the generals next to him on the 4th of July, because he identifies with autocrats and these dictators, and that's how he wants to lead, by fear. And frankly, he's doing it. We just have an obligation to push back.
Okay, let's move on to something else. This is why I think you should maybe move to Bill Weld for your next.
Are you telling me to move right now?
I guess it's just, to me, it's like a cesspool. There's this headline in the New York Times over the weekend about the Caligula administration. And the reason it was called the Caligula administration, we know Alex Acosta, the Secretary of Labor, resigned last week under pressure after it was revealed that he signed this sweetheart deal with pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, who basically had this go to work all day long and then show up after 12 hours and go to prison at night. Now we have 80 plus more girls who are now women but were sexually abused by him. We learned last week that the president and Jeffrey Epstein had a party at Mar-a-Lago, and it was just the two of them and 20-something women that were flown in to entertain two men, which kind of just turns my stomach. And then we learned that the Trump National Doral, which is a famous golf course in Florida, after news came out that they were having a basic fundraiser allowing golfers to bid on strippers to serve as their caddies, and then the strippers were going to be stripping later on at this place, that closed down. I mean, it's and by the way, as you know, this is about the 12th person that's either been accused of beating up their wife or girlfriend, or being pro-life but telling their mistress to get an abortion. I mean, it goes on and on and on, this kind of stuff. So I guess I always wonder, because I've known you for a long time. How tough is it for you to – I mean, the economy's great, but, you know
– At what
between
cost?
Between Caligula and the immigration thing, which maybe you disagree with, and this latest thing, this racist tweet. I mean, it's got to be tough.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think Acosta – his time came, and the Epstein case rearing its head again, I think, put rightfully focus on how – I mean, look, we're, a year or two removed from the Me Too movement, and this was sort of, you know, the most recent iteration in that you have to be held accountable for not doing what you could to hold someone accountable for how he abused women. So at first I thought he was doing a pretty good job of trying to explain how he had gone from a state case that was pretty weak to at least tougher – penalties and financial,
but
you know,
your
penalties.
Support for the president is unwavering, though, I think, is what Marjorie's asking, is that can you have, if you had gone back in time 10 years ago and I said to you that your candidate is going to be someone who has been accused of rape, went to a party where there were young women who then were strippers, would you have said, yes, that's going to be the candidate? I know in the future I'm going to support that candidate.
No, of course. But I mean, the fact is, these accusations of, you know, against the president, a lot of... You know, I think this happens quite a bit. I mean, we had at the time also accusations
against him.
Accusations, yeah, and against our former president, whose wife happened to be running at the same time as the president.
But the difference is, it's important to point out, the American people didn't know those things. They knew about Jennifer Flowers when they elected Bill Clinton. We know of 20-some women now going into the second election.
The Billy Bush tape came out during the election. It wasn't like people were, oh my gosh, what a surprise.
So, Steve, to the point. I mean, you know. people.
Which one of those points?
No, well, no, Jeff, people knew who they were getting when they elected. Sure. And I got to tell you that every time I read an accusation or a charge, I mean, the president of the United States was credibly charged with rape just by a victim, yeah, allegedly, just a couple of weeks ago. We're not even talking about that because why? Why aren't we talking about that?
Because we have a short memory as a nation. But I will say, I think there's a lot of folks back in 2016 who did a protest vote. There's no way to find out how many who did a protest vote because they didn't want to vote for Hillary Clinton, or they just wanted to show that they were other than or different.
And he ran as a populist.
And I think a lot of those folks, I don't know how many of them, I think a lot of them were quite shocked that he actually ended up winning. He ran a populist campaign. He won the presidency. There's no doubt about that. I'm not one of those folks who would say that he didn't, because he didn't get the majority of the votes. But it's an opportunity as president to lead our nation and show our values as a nation. And frankly, his values are not American values. And the way he has led his personal life and his business life are not American values. The way he led his inauguration with graft and patting the pockets of his business partners and his friends are not American values. And I just look forward to the day that he's not the American president.
It sounds like you're describing the Clinton administration as far as patting their pockets and sexual dalliances.
So first of all, look at the Trump inaugural funding. He raised $107 million, paid friends of his millions of dollars. Mark Burnett likely got a couple of million dollars to be quiet, frankly, about everything that happened on The Apprentice. He had Russian oligarchs at the inaugural. He had folks who have been indicted and are in prison running the inauguration. I mean, that is not related. That did not happen in 1993, and it did not happen in 1997.
Okay. Well, why don't we talk about a little bit about the politics? Get off Trump for a second. Well, Trump is the president, obviously. But latest polls nationwide, which may not mean that much, but Trump is lagging behind Biden. Significantly lagging behind Sanders, significantly a little bit less behind Elizabeth Warren, our own senator, and I think he's beaten by 1 point by Harris. This is obviously early than national polls. It's the states that matters. But what do you make of this? Do you think it's too early, or?
Yeah, I mean, I know this sounds cliche. It seems a little early as far as the fact that there's a lot of attention right now on the Democratic candidates. The population tends to, I think, be very much what's happening this week, this month. I think as things get closer, when you get the head-to-head of who the final nominee is going to be against Trump, things will tighten. And even if he is trailing in the polls at that point, I think there's also just the hidden vote that was there in 2016. So, you know, look, I certainly have I am not putting any money. I'm not going to the new Encore Casino and putting any money on this campaign. I can tell you that, because I have no idea what's going
to
happen.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. Steve, you can respond to that. We're going over the latest headlines from Capitol Hill to Beacon Hill with Jeff Diehl and Steve Kerrigan. The conversations continue on 89.7 WGBH Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're talking politics with former State Representative Jeff Diehl and Democratic strategist Steve Kerrigan. So we spend a lot of time, more and more time lately, and Jim's not here today, but when we are, obsessing over transportation in Massachusetts, the MBTA, the trains, all those kinds of things. We took a brief diversion, though, when it turns out that the RMV in Massachusetts had not only known that hundreds of people who broke terrible laws outside of the state, including a 23-year-old young man who wound up in a terrible, tragic accident killing seven people, should not have been driving at all. Now we find out that, in addition to that, the RMV missed thousands of people in Massachusetts who should have been informed, that did bad things in Massachusetts, and the other states that should have been informed.
Yeah, vice versa. We didn't suspend licenses from Mass, and we didn't notify other states to suspend licenses either.
So this is not a good look at the RMV. It's horrible.
No, I mean, I think Aaron Devaney stepped down, was it like less than 24 hours after the news broke? Or
right, which
like
was
that?
Interesting, because as awful as that crash was and the terrible tragedy that it resulted, I didn't immediately think, well, that means that the head of the RMV has to go. There
I
must
actually
be
was
something
surprised
else
too.
Going on.
And I think what we found out later, obviously, with the bins of notifications being stored in Quincy and not being acted on, you know, I'm surprised now it's just one person that's currently stepped down. Tom Bowes, who's the head of the group that's supposed to review these things, was out of country, actually, when this all happened. He was in London and actually, I think, stayed even through the Red Sox-Yankees games after this had become fully open. And I'm surprised that he's not being held accountable at this point as well.
Steve, how does this happen? I mean, if this were a private company, you know, there are breaches that happen. There are mistakes that happen. Nobody, no company, no entity is 100% correct and perfect. But how does this had someone had to know that this wasn't happening and just either reported it and felt that nothing happened from their reporting or just ignored it?
Right. And that's the thing. And I am going to say a sentence no one ever will believe I'd ever say, but I agree with Jeff.
Come on.
I am shocked that only the first I'm shocked by the speed with which the registrar resigned. But I'm shocked that's the only person that has had that happen because, you know, that's a large organization. Right. And there are a lot of folks who've had their hands on those envelopes and put them in those bins and known that that's happened. And even if they didn't, someone should be checking every now and again to say, hey, do we have any folks who have suspended licenses we might want to tell? Because that seems
like
to eerily not be coming up.
Of license review.
And so there's a lot more folks that need to. And frankly, you know, I've heard on this show before, and Jim has talked about this a lot, about how I'm with him on not a big, like, everybody, every head must roll, every, you know, the Secretary of Transportation has to resign over this. But they should be immediately enacting reviews to make sure, because if we don't fix the systemic problem, this is just going to keep happening. Yeah, there's going to be another bin and another registry office filled with other envelopes.
And then we have, this is the part that cracks me up about the whole situation. The RMV and the FBI and the federal government wants our faces, right? And they want our voices. They want to keep those in a database. And they can't even keep track of a simple thing that has been happening since there have been driver's licenses.
Yeah,
I mean,
not so simple.
how much confidence can you have in government agencies?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because the Massachusetts licenses have actually been under review for a while. There was a feeling that they were sort of compromised as far as who could get them. And, we had to switch over to Real ID to make sure we could keep using them for air travel and for going into federal buildings. So there's already been sort of a review process of making sure our license system is more up to date. And yet it didn't take that next step of having something I would seem as logical. I mean, what I think everybody assumed was that this stuff is already electronic, but evidently it's literally mail that you have to open an envelope with. Meanwhile, like you're saying, technology, you know, expectations are also now from these federal agencies of give us, access to your facial data. You know, maybe we don't have that. Maybe it's just literally photos in a box right now. I hate to think that, but that could potentially be what's happening.
You guys, we have only about a minute and a half left, a little less actually. Do you think that Charlie Baker, the governor, needs to start riding the T, taking the commuter rail, and riding buses around Massachusetts to prove that he's can feel the pain of our fellow commuters?
Yes. I mean, the infrastructure, the lack of infrastructure investment here in the Commonwealth, despite what the governor will tell you about billions of dollars of work that they're doing, it is not seen clearly by the people who take the T as a priority. The fact that these derailments and all these problems are happening and then they still had the gall to institute a fare hike in the middle of all of that just shows a total disconnect with the riders and the people who need, by the way, don't take this just because they want to be green, although a lot of people do. Some people depend on it for their livelihood. They need to get to work, and that is the only way they can get there because they can't afford a car.
Jeff, I've never been a candidate, but I pretend that I'm a candidate consultant from time to time. If I were to talk to Governor Charlie Baker or to Mayor Marty Walsh, I would say to them, right, it looks like a stunt. You don't really mean it. But if you ride the MBTA for like 30 days or 2 weeks, it will shut everybody up from demanding that you ride the T. Why don't they just ride the T so we can stop talking about them not riding the T?
No, it makes total sense. But at the same time, but at the same time, let's fix the T. It's overdue.
All right, you two. Thanks so much for coming in. Steve Kerrigan is the CEO of the Edward M. Kennedy Community Health Center and Democratic strategist. Jeff Diehl is a Republican and former state rep. Thanks to both of you. All right, up next, we mark the 20th anniversary of Marjorie's favorite SpongeBob SquarePants with TV Authority Bob Thompson. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy has the day off. Sue O'Connell seems to have disappeared, but thank goodness I am here. And we're joined on the line to go over the latest TV developments from the 20th anniversary of SpongeBob SquarePants to a major find for Bob Ross aficionados. It's another Bob Thompson. He's a professor and founding director of the Blyer Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Hello, Bob.
Hey, Marjorie, how are you?
I am great. Great to talk to you. We got a lot of great stuff today, Bob. Let's start with your best.
I think I'm going to give the best to what you just mentioned. The New York Times released this little report a couple of days ago that nobody was quite sure where all Bob Ross's paintings were. He did one for each of 400 episodes. He did multiple versions of them. So the New York Times, being the New York Times, they went out and found them in the headquarters in Herndon, Virginia. So we're still looking for that missing Shakespeare play about Don Quixote, but we've solved the issue of where Bob Ross's paintings are.
Well, we've got a little clip from the documentary, which I want to play in just a second. But before we do, just give people an idea who may not have been painting enthusiasts or watched his show, who he was and why he was a big deal in TV history.
Yeah, okay. He did a show on PBS called The Joy of Painting from 1983 to 1994, over 400 episodes, 403 episodes, I think it was. And he essentially sat there and told you how you, sitting at home with absolutely no artistic proclivities or talents in anything, could paint a really nice landscape of a waterfall or a pristine lake or a forest or whatever. And he had this big puffy hair, and he spoke in this almost Mr. Rogers kind of calming, soothing tone. And slowly but surely, he gathered a following. And then even after he died in the mid-1990s, his legend continued to build. Now I think you can see all the episodes on the Bob Ross YouTube channel. They play in other places. We talked about him. I don't know if there was some anniversary or something a couple of years ago, but we talked about the Bob Ross phenomenon, which continues.
Well, here's this clip. This is from the New York Times, a short online documentary that they made on finding, as Bob Thompson just said, Bob Ross's huge inventory of paintings. In this scene, you'll hear the people who manage Bob Ross archives describing how to spot a Bob Ross fake.
Right now, I can pretty much recognize a Bob Ross painting.
A lot of the public, they think that any painting that has a tree and a mountain must be a Bob Ross painting.
I'm really a tree and mountain type person.
They're like sure that he's the only one that's ever painted a landscape before.
There are some telltale signs as to whether or not a painting is a real Bob Ross.
Oh, Bob. He wanted no sign of people. I don't know why he didn't like people, I guess. He touched that tree one time, one stroke. The clouds are not Bob Ross clouds.
It's like describing the taste of chocolate.
This is great. This is great. So didn't he, Bob Thompson, paint a painting right there during the show?
Oh, yes. He could. It was a 30-minute episode, and he'd introduce... he'd do the introduction of the show, and then he'd sit down and he'd say, we're going to paint a walk under the moonlight today. And sure enough, he'd do it. And you could actually learn a lot about painting, even if you didn't participate. And my guess is most people at home were not. Many were, but I'm sure most of them weren't. But you could learn how just a stroke here or a stroke there could really suggest the texture of bark or the texture of fog or the look of whatever. Now, I have to say, these are landscapes, and they are perfectly pretty landscape paintings. Some of these are apparently now going to go into the Smithsonian institution, but it'll be the National Museum of American History, which is exactly where they would belong, alongside, maybe Archie Bunker's chair and Fonzie's leather jacket, though I don't know if that's where it's going to go. These should not go in a great art museum. As much as I love this TV show, and as much as he makes the kinds of paintings that most people would much prefer than a Picasso, these are not great moments in American painting.
Yeah.
They were great moments in American television and an American personality, and also teaching people that you didn't have to be Picasso to enjoy painting a picture.
Okay, what's your worst?
Oh, this was an easy one this week. Love Island on CBS. Now, this is part of this long tradition of these courtship dating reality shows that have been going on since the beginning of the century. And you well know, I have defended these before.
Yep.
I'm not a snob against them. Temptation Island, I really, really enjoyed back in 2001 when that started. I still occasionally, even though I know how bogus it is, enjoy watching The Bachelor or The Bachelorette. But this, those shows are so bad they're good. This show is just so bad it's bad. And CBS has committed to it. It's going to be on 5 days a week for 4 weeks. It debuted on Tuesday. It's going to go into August, 5 days a week, an hour of prime time per night. So that's a pretty big commitment. And so far, it's been a sorry disappointment. Episode one got 2.7 million, which is pretty low for a network broadcast show. Friday's episode was down to 2.1 million. So CBS is stuck with 4 weeks of what appear to be a real dog on their hands.
Let's play a little clip from Love Island. But though, when I read the story in the New York Times about Love Island, I just want to be sure. Are they talking about the American version or the British version when they're talking about all these people in bathing suits all the time, having sex all the time on camera? Is this
well, the British, it is based on a British version. And, of course, the British version is more has more explicit stuff like that content than the U.S. version is, although American broadcasting is beginning to catch up with that. It is pretty salacious. And, yes, they not only are in bathing suits all the time, but the narrator keeps reminding us there are, as if we'd need a reminding. And the other problem with it is that it's so confusing as to what exactly it is. As you just pointed out, just a bunch of people hooking up, as my students would say. The great thing about The Bachelor and The Bachelorette is you've got a bunch of people competing, and at the end of each episode, some of them get roses and some of them go home. And the next week, the same thing happens, and in the end, there's one person standing, they get engaged, and they stay together for 3 weeks, and they break up.
That
we can understand how that works. Even Temptation Island, you had these couples that were being tempted. In the end, they stayed together and didn't. Here, you've got these people, and they keep – it's like musical chairs. The couples connect in different iterations, and then new people come in. There is no sense of real – it's kind of chaos narratively, and I think that's one of the problems is there isn't that great payoff that you get in those other shows.
Okay, so even though Bob has described this as a terrible show and it's worst of the week, we're going to play it anyway, the clip from Love Island USA, this dating reality show based on the British series.
Today's game, the boys will battle across a sexy boot camp.
Boys, one at a time, you will complete the commando course, and we will decide who's the sexiest sergeant. It's time to sort the men from the boys. Go!
Here's how it works. The boys must sexily navigate the obstacles in the sexiest way possible. Armed with sexy squirt guns and sexy balloons, the girls will try to derail the sexy train. The winner will be the boy who maintains his sexy the most. Got it?
Okay, I guess we got it, Bob. Let's move on.
I have never been on a singles cruise, but it sounds like that would be how the MC of some activity on a bad singles cruise would sound. And pretty much that clip, it doesn't get much better than that.
Okay, we're gonna start with a clip this next one because this has got me in a very good mood. SpongeBob SquarePants turns 20. Here's a clip for the 20th anniversary, which was surreal even for this show and featured all the main characters in live-action sequences. In this scene, SpongeBob and Patrick the Star are on his tour bus to the surface.
Before we drive to the amazing surface land, I'm required to read you these tour bus rules. Absolutely no bad language. No horseplay. And no digging, no dancing, no tanning, no cooking, no fencing, no drowning, no molting, no running, no trespassing, no peeking, and no balloons.
Aw, not even birthday balloons?
Oh my goodness, is it your birthday?
Yes.
So, Bob Thompson, why has SpongeBob been so popular for so many years?
First off, I like, of all those many, many rules, no balloons. That's so
that's
typical
right.
of SpongeBob. Where did that come from? Well, what can we say? And by the way, they just had this week, the SpongeBob birthday bash for the 20th anniversary. I think the first episode was back in May of 1999. So if my numbers are right, they're a little late for the 20th anniversary. But there is so much about this show. It is so brilliant on so many levels. First of all, it is so Dada, so surrealistic. And while kids like it because it's a talking sponge and a snail that meows, I mean, it's perfect for preschoolers who it's aimed at. It was also something that the parents
yes.
who were in the room when
yes.
the preschool were watching it probably dug it even more than the kids did. And there was plenty there for them to like. It was the opposite of Barney. Your preschooler loved Barney, and by the fourth episode, the poor adults in the room were ready to jump off a bridge.
This is true.
Because they could not stand that.
Yep.
SpongeBob is, you know, the preschooler has fallen asleep, and the parent stays in the room to complete the episode. And part of it, I think, was its total and complete naivete. It plays, starts in the late 1990s during this era where so much is irony and all of this kind of thing. And SpongeBob was just such a simple heart. He was such a pure, innocent character. And I think we found that incredibly appealing.
Yeah. They always were having such fun under the sea, Bob. It was always fun to watch. I really love that show.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say I'm one of those parents who watched that show as much as I could with my kids. I mean, everybody loved it. It was fun for both sides and clever, very clever.
Oh, very much so. Tom Kenny, the voice of none other than SpongeBob, the star of the show, is from Syracuse, New York.
I did not know that. Bob Thompson.
Yes, I think he gets back.
I learned something.
And I was in the 10th anniversary of SpongeBob. I was not invited for the 20th, but they did a documentary called Square Roots in 2009 for the 10th, and I appeared in that, and am very proud to have said I was in a SpongeBob
episode.
Oh,
my goodness. What's it called, the 10th anniversary? What's it called?
Square Roots. Okay.
Square Roots. I love it.
Yeah, anyway.
Congratulations, Bob.
Oh, yeah.
You're part of the SpongeBob Bikini Bottom history. So,
well, it was a documentary, so technically it wasn't an official episode, but I say that it was.
Okay. So Rip Torn, longtime actor, big on stage and in the movies, dead at 88. I did not know. I mean, I knew him for the Larry Sanders Show, as a lot of people did. Gary Shandling was the star. That was ran in the 90s on HBO. I did not know his long and checkered past, including the fact that Jack Nicholson wound up in the cult classic 60s film Easy Rider because he lunged at Dennis Hopper with a knife, supposedly, and that he hit Norman Mailer, the famed journalist and novelist, with a hammer.
Yeah, and then Norman Mailer bit his ear. And
yeah.
That, by the way, made it into the movie, no less.
Yeah.
Even though it was happening... first of all, if we were to take a deep breath right now, talk really fast, and simply name the Broadway shows, the films, and the television series he appeared in, we'd be here for a long time. He has a long, long, long resume. But it's also kind of a miracle that he made it to 88, because as the HR department says, he made a lot of bad lifestyle choices. You mentioned a couple of them. That was the Mailer thing was surrounding a 1970 film. And then at one point he was arrested for breaking into a bank, but he didn't go into it to rob it. He thought it was his house.
Yeah, that was
and
just a few years ago.
Intoxicated in front of the ATM machine.
So,
I don't remember.
So he's well into his senior citizen years. I think it said in the story, it said it was 2010. So he's 88 now. So when he was 79, he's breaking into a bank with a loaded gun. But I think most people will remember him if they watch. We should play the little sound from him from the Larry Sanders.
Oh, please do.
Yeah, we got it right here. This is when he was on the Where's my thing? Oh, here it is. When he's playing Artie in the Larry Sanders Show, and Larry Sanders, of course, is played by Gary Shandling, and this is when he's given some advice on how to deal with approaching actress Lori Loughlin, who, as we all know from more recent, she got in trouble in the US paying illegally for her kid to get into college. Anyway, this is Sanders thinks that thinks that Artie stole his wallet.
You know, Lori Loughlin took my money.
Oh, come on.
No, I'm telling you. When I went for the cheese.
When you went for the cheese? That's what you're calling it now?
I don't know. She was at my house, right? And she was playing with my wallet.
Yeah, I bet. Listen, you got to be very careful when you accuse a friend of stealing money, because many years ago, I was in New York with Lenny Bruce, and he accused me of taking $50 from him, and it turned very ugly, and I popped him.
You know, you've told me this story before, and you took the money.
That may be.
Okay, I said it wrong in the beginning, before the introduction. It was Lori Loughlin that supposedly stole his money. So he was kind of a big deal in that sort of, not B actor, but not the leading man, but the second leading man in plays and movies for decades.
That's right, and he often played a similar kind of character, not always, but this sort of... But his masterpiece was what we just heard, the Larry Sanders Show. That went from... for six seasons, started in 92, ended in 98, and he played this kind of Machiavellian producer. And even though he said these outrageous things, even though he was offensive, there was a certain lovability to him that Rip Torn could really pull off. And some of the funniest lines in that show would be delivered by him, who's essentially the boss. He did other things. There was a movie he did in 72, I think, called Payday, where he was a country music singer, a really good film. Of course, he was in Men in Black. That's probably the second
thing. That's right. I remember him in Men in Black, yeah.
Right. But his real masterpiece was The Larry Sanders Show. And you're right, he was not the lead character, but he certainly was central to the success of that show. I love how you chose that clip where... Larry then says, I've heard this story 100 times before. That reminds me of a certain co-host who isn't present today.
That's right. We certainly tell the same stories over and over and over again. But let's move on, Bob Thompson. And we are talking to Bob Thompson, our TV guy. Tell us about this series, Pose.
Oh, yes. Okay. So is this in its second season? And we talked about, I think I gave this a what to watch when it first started.
Yes, you did.
Started. This is on FX, which does a lot of ambitious kind of programming. Anyway, the first season, it takes place in the ballroom culture scene in New York City. More transgender actors than in any series up till now in television history. And the second season begins in the early 90s, 1990, I think it was. So it does a lot of interesting things, of course, gets into AIDS, HIV, and all the rest of it. But this past week, they did an episode that's getting an awful lot of attention where one of the major characters meets her demise and she's murdered. And it was a very melodramatic episode. I actually thought it was a wonderful episode. Some people, including within the trans community, are not so happy about it. But in the end, of course, they put up this card after the credits. More than 1,000 trans and gender nonconforming people have been murdered globally since 2016. So it was an episode that was trying to make a point, which I think this series does quite a bit. I really like the series.
Was the trans community upset? Why?
Well, some that, first of all, this character, who was really a great character, should not have been...
Candy.
Should not have been killed off, for one thing, one way or the other. And second, the idea that some people had said it's upsetting enough that we watch this within our community in real life that they didn't find it entertaining to make it part of the show. And a number of nuanced arguments throughout. Mostly, though, it's the series itself has gotten a lot of acclaim, and mostly this episode has as well. Although if you're a follower of the series, it was a very tough episode to watch.
Okay, well, here's some sound from that latest episode of Pose, which focuses on this terrible attack against one of the main characters, Candy, that Bob just mentioned, played by Angelica Ross. And Candy is one of the five trans women of color who make up the show's leading cast.
The world has its eyes on us, and I need to catch that gaze. You hear me?
We've seen enough. You are not a dancer.
Why are you always reading me the riot act, pray tell?
She hasn't come home yet.
She's been taking tricks down at the motel on Grant.
No one in the whole world cares about her but us. She's our sister.
What happens to Angelica Ross? I guess her appearances are done. She's gone, the woman that plays Candy.
Well, one never knows. She certainly made a lot of appearance in this episode after she had already died. I don't know if they'll continue to have her come back in spirit or not.
Yeah, that's one of the things I like about one of my things I'm watching all the time, Big Little Lies, is that the abusive husband keeps reappearing in the series. He was a great character, and they've got the flashbacks of him. So, Bob Thompson.
We should talk about that show next week when Jim comes back, because that has been incredible this season.
I would love to talk about that, and I am obsessed with Russell Crowe playing Roger Ailes in Loudest Voice in the
Me
Room.
Too.
Oh, my God. It is a takedown of Fox News, which I'm not a fan of, so it makes me very happy. But we'll wait till next.
Last night's episode was crazy in that show.
Oh, my God. We'll talk about that next week. But meanwhile, what should we be watching this week, Bob?
Well, this is my second week in a row recommending Apollo programming. Last week, great recommendation, that American Experience, three parts, 2 hours per part, was really, really, really good. And now let's recommend for Saturday, which is the actual 50th anniversary, July 20th. That'll be the date itself. BBC America is doing something called Moon Landing Live. And I've seen ABC's, NBC's, CBS's coverage of the moon landing, but I have not seen how the rest of the world covered it. And apparently this is going to have all kinds of footage of news broadcasts, not only from the U.S., but from abroad as well. I think that will be really interesting.
Well,
that's BBC America, July 20th.
Okay. Yeah, they've got tons of stuff about the moon landing. It's been pretty neat to watch, I think, sort of remembering more innocent time, let's put it that way, Bob, huh?
Well, yeah, I think, between the moon landing in July and Woodstock in August was really one of the last great gasps of American optimism before all kinds of things started falling apart.
Bob, thank you so much. Looking forward to Big Little Lies and Roger Ailes next week.
Oh, I can't wait. Thanks.
Thank you. Bob Thompson joins us every week, every Monday usually. He's the founding director of the Blyer Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Coming up, Andrew Cabral is here for another edition of Law and Order. I believe Sue O'Connell will be returning from her undisclosed location. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Boston Public Radio, Andrew Cabral is here for another edition of Law and Order with a look at the Massachusetts Department of Corrections. Now that they've enforced stricter rules about visiting inmates, visitation rates are down. It's not just furthering isolating prisoners, it could mean recidivism rates go up. From there, we open the lines and ask you if the GOP has a racism problem. Theresa May is calling out Trump for the racist comments he's lobbed at the four diverse and progressive Democratic congresswomen, but not one Republican has said a word. Then all wrapped up, we get the Reverends Arianne Monroe and Emmett Price idea on this. We talk hurricane season with WGBH science correspondent Heather Goldstone, and we wrap things up asking if you want to breed your kid to be an expert capitalist. Why not? If so, there is a camp for that. All that is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston. Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy is out. I am here with Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows and NACN. Thank you very much, Sue O'Connell.
Marjorie, my pleasure.
Stepping into the breach, as it were.
Into the breach.
The Browdy breach. Okay. Joining us on the line now for another edition of Law and Order is Andrew Cabral, the CEO of Ascend and former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety. Andrew Cabral, thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
Hey, you all.
You miss Bud?
How are you?
Yeah, we're great. How are you?
Good.
Well, very good. So we're going to start talking about the editorial that was in the Boston Globe this morning about the Department of Corrections making a mockery of these solitary confinement regulations that were supposed to have been changed in these new rules. What is going on here, former sheriff of Suffolk County?
This was very surprising to me. Not that the editorial was written, but that there was a reason for them to write the editorial. The legislature had gotten together and, well, there was the Criminal Justice Reform Act of 2018 happened. It had, it was very comprehensive. It tackled a number of different issues. One of the things that it did was it created this oversight committee that's called the Restrictive Housing Oversight Committee, and it's specifically geared toward solitary confinement. It has 11 members on it. They include folks from the Disability Law Center, the Prisoners Legal Services in Massachusetts, National Association of Social Workers, and I think a couple of other groups. And the job of this committee, because the issue of the deleterious impact of solitary confinement on inmates had been a big part of the criminal justice, the research and the data around the Criminal Justice Reform Act, this oversight committee was formed to look specifically at how solitary confinement was being used and to be able to weigh in on the use of solitary confinement. And according to the editorial, back in March, the DOC started to sort of find ways to get around this oversight committee and to get around the purpose of the oversight committee and created these things called secure adjustment units, which is a different name for solitary confinement. In solitary confinement, inmates can be confined alone for up to 22 hours a day. These secure adjustment units had inmates that could be confined up to 21 hours a day.
So, Andrew, how does that happen? I mean, do people just sit in a room, right, and say, okay, solitary confinement works for us because we can put people in there and it's less work for us or less of a problem for the rest of the staff? So why don't we just look at this law and change the name of solitary confinement to secure adjustment units and we'll just keep doing it until someone notices? Is that what happens?
Well, there are a number of I don't want to oversimplify this, right? So there are reasons for the use of solitary confinement. There are no good reasons for the overuse of solitary confinement as a disciplinary measure. What is shocking here is that there would be an actual legislative oversight committee that's very specific and very targeted, and that through the use of renaming things and the use of emergency regulations, they're keeping people from the very oversight that the formation of the committee was designed to provide. So
it's more of a First Amendment. I mean, solitary confinement can be good, can be bad, can be neutral, but it's more of an effort to squash the First Amendment rights and of this oversight committee.
I think it's more. It appears to be more of an effort to squash the enforcement right of the oversight committee. The oversight committee is there to literally provide oversight on the use, as a matter of policy, of solitary confinement in the Department of Correction. That doesn't mean that a person cannot, as a result of a serious infraction, be put in solitary confinement. It means you can't be put in solitary confinement for very long periods of time or periods of time that are not commensurate with the level of offense. I mean, solitary confinement has been used, and it traditionally has been used, as a disciplinary measure. Where you see it overused, it is being used purely as a mechanism of social control and at the threat of which is designed to keep people in line. But the research is very clear about the effect of solitary confinement on an inmate, especially excessive solitary confinement, on an inmate's mental health, which only ultimately makes them more of a discipline problem because their mental health issues are exacerbated. My, you know, among the many issues that I have with what's going on is the idea that there's a legislative oversight committee that is being effectively neutered based on what's in this editorial by simply renaming, by calling solitary confinement by a different name and by using the use of emergency regulations to suppress the ability of the committee to
well, the politicians look entirely neutered, if you ask me. They're also, the DOC is also saying, and this is a pattern, by the way, I think we're seeing across the country, whether it's right. the federal prisons or the state prisons, they basically are saying, drop dead to all the politicians. Politicians say, okay, that's fine, that's fine. They're telling them, that these committee members, they can't come to visit the facilities without advance notice. They can't talk to the press or the public without consent of the committee chair, and that would be the Secretary of Public Safety himself. So the legislature looks ridiculous, don't they?
I'm not sure why they haven't. I'm not sure exactly how long this has been going on. The editorial says that the undoing of the rules and regulations happened in March. So I'm not sure why people haven't been called before legislative committee hearings to publicly answer on the record how the emergency regulations have been put in place, what they're being asked publicly to define the differences between solitary confinement and a restrictive housing unit, because it doesn't really seem to be, especially in terms of the amount of time that an inmate is in is alone. There doesn't seem to be much of a difference. I'm not sure why the purpose of having an oversight committee in the legislature is to provide oversight and to have hearings.
Exactly.
Not if we change the definition or the word oversight. Maybe if we just change it to compliance. Compliant people, that would do it. So it's an amazing story. I want to switch gears and talk about this other story, which I think we've talked to you in the past about, Andrea Cabral, and it's the lawsuit regarding what's being described in the Globe as a telephone racket. The lawsuit was filed this week. It was about this phone company, Securus Technologies, and Sheriff Thomas Hodgson and other sheriffs across the state are named as in the lawsuit. And, you know, what I think we sometimes forget is that people that are in incarcerated are also still consumers. And right. And this is a lawsuit that's looking to protect their rights as consumers to be able to not pay $1 billion to make phone calls to their loved ones. Right.
Well, I should start out by saying this particular story I don't have. So I haven't had a chance to read the whole story. But certainly what you cite as the history of the burden that the fees place not just on the individual inmate, but usually largely on the individual inmate's family. This has been moving toward coming to a sort of a critical mass for a very, very long time. In fact, I even remember when I was sheriff, this was an issue, and that was, we're going back at least 5 years. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that particularly where you have an institution, whether it's the sheriff's office or the DOC, that has been unwilling to sort of rework the contract, to lower the fees, to make it less onerous, that you would get to the point where this particular lawsuit is right now. And ultimately, I do think it needs to have a court look at it. A judge or a jury needs to look at this and come to a resolution as to what is fair and constitutional. And you're right. Certainly the family members ought to be treated as consumers, however unwilling they might be. You either accept the charge for the phone call,
right, or
you
don't.
But again, the other part of this that is really important is to understand why and how these contracts came about. There's no excuse for a contract that's onerous or unduly burdensome on the person who has to pay the fees. But they come about as a result of government not being willing to fund prison systems the way they should, and as a result, they go out looking for, they're encouraged to go out and look for different sources of revenue. And one of the ways that incarceration facilities make money on these contracts is they get a piece of this too. And that contributes to the amount that people are charged per phone call.
And we'll just remind people that some of the people in the jails are there because they can't make bail money. It's not necessarily because they've all been convicted.
No, not convicted. Okay. And it's pretty big money going to a lot of these jails too that could certainly sway the preferences, I suppose, of the people making the decisions, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, over time, whether it's a little or a lot, you know, in budgetary times where, you know, you consistently are asked to cut your budget or you're consistently put in the position of asking for a supplemental budget because the amount of money you were given at the beginning of the budget was already going to be inadequate. And that's kind of the way budgets are done. They underfund you at the beginning, and then you have to come back around midway through the fiscal year and ask for a supplemental budget. Regardless of how much money it is, you come to depend on it. Because everybody's budget, you sort of, it's always living by the grace of the slaughter. And so, you know, from year to year, you actually don't know how much money you're going to have or what things are going to contribute to a need for an increase in your budget. And I certainly agree that if there's a need to decrease a budget, if there's just not as much going on or there's a decrease in inmates or the amount of programming has somehow been cut or you know the person in charge is not going to do anything to bring that programming back, then maybe you should be taking a look at how to decrease that budget. But in cases like this where even when I was sheriff, as I said, it was more than 5 years ago, we were being told, go out and find your own sources of revenue. And that makes these contracts come into existence.
We're talking with Andrea Cabral. We're doing a little law and order update. Andrea, I want to talk to you. We want to talk to you, too, about this body cam bill, which, again, we're talking about lawmakers and we're talking about one of the things that Massachusetts does not do well in is the public records access to both the public and the press.
Horrible. And the public looks like chumps. They get away with, who knows what they're getting away with, and we just don't seem to care.
We have no idea. And one of the challenges around this emerging body cam are exemptions that have been apparently this proposal to carve out exemptions. You know, part of me looks at this and says, you know, I understand the urge to protect innocent people, to protect people who may want to talk to police but don't want to be recorded while they're talking to police, even to protect police officers and law enforcement in their personal time. But overall, this recent effort to exempt the information from body cams in this proposal seems like a bad idea.
Yeah, I'm not sure what went into this. Like, you know, I wouldn't presume to speak for the state representative who filed it. It was Denise Provost from Somerville.
Yep.
And I only know what's been written about it. But this idea that the video could only be used by prosecutors, investigators, courts, or litigants.
Yeah.
And it would allow police to sort of edit it.
Yes. It undermines the whole thing, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah. It seems as though she filed it for the purpose of, she sort of made this allusion to this is evidence, this is not entertainment. And I'm not sure what her thinking was in terms of where this video goes.
But,
as Secretary Galvin pointed out, there are already provisions in place that shield a person who does not want their face to be shown, who does not want their identity to be known, who gets captured on this body cam video, and you have to balance the right of privacy mm-hmm. of individuals against the public's, the deep need, especially in 2019, for the public to see how police interact with them.
But there is this emerging entertainment market. You know, the police shows that show people before they've been even arrested. There's a web station that just broadcasts every call police go on. And people who are inebriated or suffer from mental illness often sign away their rights to have this broadcast, and it does turn into there's this whole entertainment market of watching people.
Yeah, but this
be
is
arrested.
This is a trust issue between the black community, which has been unfairly targeted by cops.
I don't disagree.
So how do you have trust if you can't see the the video.
Right, but
I
if
think.
You but if you end up with body police cam information being broadcast, even if your face, if you're living in a small area or a small neighborhood and your face is blurred out, or if you feel compelled by the police who are asking you to sign this release so they can broadcast it on a police entertainment web, like, you know, the Bad Boys, the cop show, you know, there's got to be some level for protection to make sure you don't turn into a commodity. No?
Right. So I'd say two things in response to what you both said. I'd say first, it's a matter of trust, not just for the Black community. It's a matter of trust for all communities to see how police interact with them. So everyone should be able to get a sense of this. But certainly, I think you start from the proposition that the footage can be used for all relevant purposes. And then you make sure, as Secretary Galvin points out, he says that there are already exemptions in the law. You can withhold sensitive information from law enforcement records. You can withhold victims' and witnesses' identities, intimate details about private citizens, documents that might, you know, compromise an investigation. You start with the proposition that the footage is available, and then you sort of backtrack from that to make sure in a way that is as minimally restrictive as possible that people's privacy rights are protected. I don't think what you do is you sort of give a blanket restriction and just say this is just for the purpose of court, just for the purpose of prosecutors having access to it, just so that judges and juries can weigh it, because it does have a public policy purpose.
Right. I think I'm just fresh. I've been on a podcast binge lately, and one of the podcasts I listened to talked about just how much of this video information gets as we spoke about earlier, becomes a revenue stream for the police departments, small towns and municipalities that can use their content to become entertainment. And it's usually, you know, the lowest rungs of our society who are suffering from it. I mean, it was always fun when you watch cops and watch people get chased through the bushes, and then they'd be this disclaimer saying, you know, a reminder, these people have not been arrested or convicted, or, you know.
Right, but which shouldn't be enough.
Right. It just seems like this is a whole brand new world of both protection for society, as you say, like we should be able to see what the police are doing, all of us. We should be able to participate in how law enforcement acts. And we need to find a way to protect ourselves from becoming a commodity.
Well, also keep in mind that one of the most ironic things is that when it's very, very difficult for the press to get the identities of police officers who are charged.
Right.
So regular people, their information is grist for the mill. And I'm not suggesting that police officers' information should be grist for the mill. I'm suggesting that everyone should be treated with the same amount of respect for privacy, and the potential effect of going viral. That said, it is absolutely a tradition that when people are arrested for crimes, regular people, their mugshots, their names, and the cities and towns that they're from are prominently displayed in the paper, some more than others.
Right.
So, Andrew Cabral, many of us heard about this, these Border Patrol agents on this secret Facebook group that was really filled with all this sexist and racist and vulgar content. Carla Provost, who's the new chief, said that these are all inappropriate texts and contrary to the honor and integrity that she expects from her agents, et cetera. But it turns out that she had been on the Facebook postings itself, as far as I know, just posting innocuous remarks. But nonetheless, it would be hard to see how she couldn't see what else was on there while she was posting her innocuous remarks. And she's in charge of the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think her response, you know, to this, as though, you know, the post came as a complete surprise to her, I would say at the very least is disingenuous. It would have made infinitely more sense if she said, actually, I've been aware of this Facebook group. I've only posted on, you know, these particular times, and I've never posted anything of vulgar content, but I was certainly aware of it. Would have been the most honest response. I find it hard to believe that, I guess the group is called I'm 10-15. I'm not quite sure what that means.
Neither am I.
But they are past and current Border Patrol agents among the members. They started out, I think they had 9,500 members. Since this story, it's now down to 4,000. But you're right, the content was vile, absolutely vile, and not from everyone. Certainly, it seems as though among the supervisors, most of the supervisors, the postings were innocuous, but it is like Twitter. If you're visiting the Facebook page to post, you're generally, usually you're looking through the Facebook page. It's kind of hard to not know what your colleagues are saying, particularly where the group is a professional group. On Twitter, it's sort of a wide open universe. But anybody you follow and anybody who retweets something, you'll see it. Here, this is a private group. I mean, you know it's your colleague, so it's very difficult for me to believe that she didn't know.
But Andrea,
that,
you know,
these postings were like this.
This is far from new. I mean, you know, in 2012, Chris Ferrone wrote a cover story for the Boston Phoenix about Pax Centurion, which was the Boston Patrolman Association's newsletter,
right.
Which was, you know, on a good day, was awful to just minorities, women, gays, Muslims, and everyone else, and you know, had said just terrible things about then Governor Deval Patrick, about Occupy Boston. And everybody in law.
Oh, I remember when I was in Ralph Martin's DA's office.
Yeah.
Ralph, that was the first time I became aware of that particular publication. It was because of the incredibly racist cartoons and comments and stories that they had about him.
And that just exists. I mean, it seemed very hard to get anyone to get upset about it because it was a union newsletter. And sort of fast forward, here we are in 2019. And now we have private Facebook posts, and it's the same content. What's happening to try and hire people who don't hold such bigoted, racist, biased views?
To my knowledge, not very much. I mean, I remember doing we covered the story on Jim and Marjorie right after Trump was inaugurated. One of the first things we heard about the Customs Border Patrol was that he was trying to very sharply increase the number of personnel, which was clearly a warning sign for everything that was to come. But they couldn't attract a certain the caliber of Border Patrol agent that they were, that at least the criteria on paper required. So they literally were asking to be able to diminish the qualifications. And I remember saying on Jim and Marjorie's show, even back then, I can tell you exactly what's going to happen. They're going to get a poorer quality of person, and the abuses are going to start almost immediately. There will not only be ethical lapses and financial lapses, there will be actual physical and sexual abuse because they are bringing in a lower quality of person. You can even have a higher quality of person and still have those problems. The minute you lower your standards, you're really asking for it. And so that's exactly what's happened. He's been able to ramp up the number of personnel, but he has done it at the expense of the quality of those personnel. And I'm sure that many of them are either, you know, are like-minded, I would say, maybe not necessarily members of groups, but like-minded to the folks who do these postings. And it goes directly to, these are people who are federal and state public servants or city public servants. It goes directly to what is in their minds when they are supposed to be protecting all of the public. There is a direct connection. This is not a First Amendment issue. This is an issue about how your ideas and your disrespect and the dehumanizing way that you refer to people that you're supposed to protect translates into how you physically treat them when you are on the street, and whether or not they get the same measure of justice as people as you see as people that you see as more deserving and more human than they are.
We're talking to Andrea Cabral, the former sheriff of Suffolk County. Andrea, after you go, we're going to open the lines and talk to our listeners about what's Trump's racist attack on the four women of color who are progressive representatives, including our own Ayanna Pressley here in Massachusetts. When we talked to you last week, you were upset about a lack of movement by Speaker Pelosi on impeachment. We do have Mueller coming in next week. I don't know if that's going to matter. But some people would say that this attack on these four women, when basically the president told these four women that they should come back to the countries they came from, called the countries they came from, which is, of course, is erroneous because three of the four of them are from here. But anyway, called the countries they supposedly came from the worst, most corrupt and inept anywhere in the world. And he says they should go back and fix those countries before they tell Americans how to do anything. Ayanna Pressley took the high road, I would, in my estimation, saying that this is what racism looks like and we are the democracy looks like and we're not going anywhere except back to D.C. to fight for the families you marginalize and vilify every day. That was her response to the President of the United States. But I just wanted to get your take on this whole thing vis-a-vis the racism of the president, vis-a-vis the reaction or lack thereof from Republicans. I just wanted to ask your take on this whole latest discouraging situation.
Well, I mean, the president of the United States is a racist and a white supremacist. That is a fact. Beyond that, I don't comment on it beyond that because I also know that the reason for that tweet is to distract from the fact that he's very worried, I believe, about what's in Jeffrey Epstein's vault. He is very close to Jeffrey Epstein for a very long time, and it appears as though the federal government has sort of wrapped its head around the scope of Epstein's abuse and the very powerful people that he's associated himself with over the years, and that Trump is one of those. I think he's worried about that. I think he is very worried about Mueller testifying whenever that is going to be, because it actually puts the face of the investigator before the American people, and Mueller will have to say the words that are in the report, which is that he did not find conspiracy, but that is not the same as collusion, and that he found numerous instances of obstruction, which goes completely against no collusion, no obstruction mantra that he's been spouting. And I think that he's very worried about the fact that he's going to continue to do it, and I think he's going to continue to promote it, but I think he has a sense of how the way migrants and refugees are being treated and the fact that, you know, there's tons of footage now of people literally being held in what I consider to be concentration camps, children being held, not being showered, not having access to adequate food. There's a bunch of adolescent girls. Nobody seems to have any idea where they are. I think that those kinds of things are the things he's trying to distract the country from, and that the media shouldn't buy into it. I think Ayanna Pressley's response is spot on, which she says this is what racism looks like. It's not like it's the first time we've, you know, seen it in this country, so we're not going anywhere. We're going back to fighting on these issues. That should be the take of every Democrat. That should be the take of every independent who cares about this country. That should be the take of the media as well, is to not let him light a match to something and distract us with a fire when there's a conflagration a few blocks away. So that's my response to it, is that you're not going to get away with distracting us on this. We know exactly what it is you're doing to this democracy in this country, and that's what we're going to focus on.
Andrea Cabral, thanks for joining us. She joins us
very welcome
every week for Law and Order, former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety. She is the CEO of Ascend. Lots to talk about. We want you to join the conversation now. We're opening up the lines and asking you, what about Trump and his racist dog whistle? Is that going to work in the 2020 race or not? This is 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy has the day off. Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows and NECN is with us, and we're doing exactly what Andrew Cabral said
we shouldn't do,
which is further fan the flames about the president.
As soon as I was saying that, I was like,
well, we're doing it anyway.
We're doing it anyway.
Trump rebooted his Obama birther obsession yesterday, just in time for another election. Of course, with Obama out of his immediate line of vision, he's found a proxy for his racist rhetoric. Those would be the four progressive Democratic congresswomen, all of them women of color. The president tweeted, why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came? Of course, going back from where they came would largely mean going back to the United States, since Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was born in New York, Rashida Tlaib was born in Michigan, Ayanna Pressley was born in Cincinnati, and Ilhan Omar is a Somali-born, naturalized American. All United States citizens, like Trump, they are all American. Just about everybody's calling the president out for his racist language and attitude. Even 10 Downing Street says this is rhetoric that's unacceptable, but not a word from his own party. According to the LA Times, the only Republican who said something is Bill Weld, saying that his comments are not just embarrassing, but disgusting. We're opening lines and asking you, is this a huge problem for the GOP? Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-7970. While fellow Democrats have pounced on Biden for his recent comments about busing and segregationists, how is that to Republicans not calling out Trump? If you're a Trump supporter or a Republican like Jeff Deal, we just spoke to him. He ran Trump's campaign in Massachusetts. We'd love to hear from you as well. 877-301-8970, BPR at WGBH.org. You can tweet us at Boston Public Radio. I mean, is this is a distraction, as Andrew Cabral just said?
It's all those things. I think Andrew Cabral is completely right. However, you know, this is a statement from the president of the United States of America. It's not just a tweet. It's a statement from the White House. You know, we can't just underestimate it or dismiss it because it's on social media. And secondly, you know, I think this really gives America an opportunity to divide people. We keep dividing people. And if we're going to be dividing people, let's divide it. If you don't think that that tweet, that statement from the president of the United States was racist, then you go over there. The rest of us will be standing over here. There's a lot of understandable things that happen in life with us white people that sometimes we don't recognize racism. Sometimes we don't recognize privilege. We don't recognize institutional racism. And it's because of how we were brought up. It's because of where we live. There are outside things that influence our experience of white as white people being unable to recognize racism when we see it. This is an opportunity, though, for those of us of a certain age. We know that that phrase, go back to where you came from, has never been said to a white person, never been said to an immigrant from Norway, never been said to an immigrant of Canada. It's only ever said to people of color, and it's racist.
Well, what I don't get is the strategy here, if it's not just a distraction, is this because, like I said to Jeff Deal, the president's poll numbers go up and up. The economy is very good. So is the thinking that playing to white resentment will usher him in again in 2020, that when the chips are down, you just send out some racist tweets and there's enough Americans who are racist that they're going to go for this?
Yes, and again, and Andrea's right, we cannot not talk about this in the media. So instead of talking more about the tragedy and the horror of the tender age babies who have been torn from their families, that are living in squalid conditions, and I would call them concentration camps as well. Instead of talking about those things, we're talking about this. So he very much wins the day again, because no one's going to learn anything more about the president from these tweets, but we have to talk about it.
Well, part of the racism, if he holds, is evident in those camps. I mean, he talked about from the word go, when he walked on the stairs with his wife, he said that, you know, the Mexicans were coming, they were rapists, not all of them. Some were not rapists, but a lot of them were, and they were criminals and so forth. And the people that are on the border that are held in these cages that we saw these horrific pictures of Friday night were people of color, and the babies that are separated from their parents, they're not African Americans, they're not Black Americans, but they're Latinos and Latinas and Mexicans and Guatemalans and Salvadorans and all that. So anyway, what do you make of this? Should this be the kind of stuff that pushes Democrats to move to impeachment, or do we just sit back and say, well, people in cages, children separated from their parents, going into people's homes, as he didn't do that many actually over the weekend, and dragging people
out.
Could be coming. Saying that foreign women of color should go back to the countries they came from. Is this just where we're at until the election, and maybe after the election as well?
The number is 877-301-8970. We're going to go to Steve in Taunton. Hey, Steve, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. What's on your mind?
It's true that statement that Trump made is only made against people of color. I've heard it made about whites and others, So I don't think, number one, that that's true.
Well, what kind of white person? Like an immigrant, alien? What kind of white person?
It doesn't make a difference. It doesn't make a difference. You categorize it as only people of color. And that's certainly not true.
So,
but anyways, that's not what I wanted to say. I just wanted to make that statement. But what's happening here with Trump is what I've said for a very long time, and that is the liberals and the media has exploded at every little thing he does, that when something major comes up like this, and I thought that was egregious, right? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. People look at it and say, just something else. It's common now. They're out to get him at every point for everything. So when something serious happens, it just goes by the board.
So what should they do, Steve? I mean, Steve, I'm... But Steve, remember when Obama wore the tan suit and everybody freaked out on the right and the Republicans and the media reported about how President Barack Obama wore a tan suit and how it was breaking with protocol? You know, the coverage of the person in the White House is often wall to wall and is often about everything. It just seems in this case, the smallest steps over the line would have been a presidency ender for other presidents. No.
Well, yeah, he's definitely a Teflon president. But what happens is that because the nation is so divided, that when you start doing something, when you start becoming political, like take, for example, the soccer team, right? Now, what happened was, and Marjorie will attest to this, but Republicans acted, Trump supporters acted the same way that liberals acted 2 years ago. And I'm saying that Trump supporters now, they don't like that national soccer team, which is ridiculous.
We're getting off, Steve, make your point, because we're kind of far afield here. Make your point quick about the soccer team, because we get a lot of calls.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
But anyways, people are taking sides, right? Just like the way Marjorie will tell you, people are called in during the Super Bowl, wanted the Pats to lose, because the Pats, Belichick and Brady were friends with Trump.
All right, Steve. Okay. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you very much for the call.
All right. We're going to go to Brendan, who's calling us safely from the car. Hey, Brendan, how you doing? Welcome to Boston Public Radio.
I'm good. Thank you. And I am definitely hands-free. So I hope
good job. Good
okay.
man. Good man.
Thank you. That's just doing my part. So I think the first piece, I just want to vehemently disagree with what the last caller said. I mean, this is what Trump tweeted is the oldest, most common racist trope out there. This has never been used against anyone who's white.
Well,
I mean,
I also want to point out that
well,
it may have been
to Italians, you know.
No,
the
but the point is that they are for Congress. They are for people of color, right? I can't imagine that he would have said it to Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, right?
Exactly.
Would he have said to Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, "Go back to your own country"?
And it's even beyond dog whistle. I mean, you know, the Republican Party for a long, long time has engaged sort of coyly in this dog whistle politics of racism. Trump's just fully embraced it all the way since he announced back in 2015 to today. This is just the latest example. And my concern with 2020 is that because it's just the latest example, it's going to get swept up in all the other craziness that this guy's done in the White House since he got sworn in. And I think Democrats and hopefully some of the super PACs that I know Democrats aren't taking a lot of super PAC money, but they can run ads like this in the election cycle. Just put all this stuff in an attack ad, 30-second ad, and just hammer it on every TV network across the country. Here's just a quick list of all the incredibly atrocious things Trump has both done in terms of government and in terms of his statements, and just really hammer that home.
But Brendan, the point that Steve made earlier, the previous caller, which is a valid point, is that, you know, we in the media get accused of over-covering Trump, of hammering him, of reporting all of the things that his administration has done wrong, or people in his administration. I mean, we have a president of the United States that just 2 weeks ago was credibly charged with sexual assault, with rape by an alleged victim, and we're not even talking about that anymore. Can you imagine if Barack Obama had been accused of assault, where we would be and how long we would be talking about it? So what do we do? What does media do?
I mean, I just think you guys are doing your job. I would disagree with him entirely. I mean, if any politician engage in this type of behavior, it needs to have a spotlight shown on it. It needs to be discussed. aggressively. I think that's a solemn obligation of the press, and I think you guys on this show do a really great job of
Thank you, Brendan.
Well, thank you very much, Brendan. You can call anytime.
All right,
you.
Thanks for calling call. In.
But, you know, the thing is, I mean, I am no fan of the president. I really am not a fan of the president, but I do try to look for good things. So you could say, okay, China's economy is being hurt, and maybe that's because of the president's stands on trade. Maybe that's going to make some change for China. I don't think things are going to work out necessarily well with – I don't think North Korea is going to get rid of its nuclear weapons. But maybe the fact that he talks to this guy, Kim Jong-un, is a good thing, makes us a little bit safer. You know, I can look for these things on the edges. Obviously, the economy is good. But I guess at the bottom of it, you have a guy who, as you just said – has been accused of rape. He's been accused by 20-some women of other really creepy things. We know now he and Jeffrey Epstein, who has had sex allegedly with at least 100 underage girls,
right, but
had a party
and is
together.
A convicted sex offender, Jeffrey Epstein.
Convicted sex offender.
Who went to jail as a convicted sex offender.
Yes, and there have been people who've associated with him post the first conviction because he gets such a slap on the wrist.
Yes, he's also allegedly a billionaire, which apparently he's another fake billionaire.
And then you have this. It's kind of like, wow. I mean, who is this guy?
What I worry too, and is that the voter, that people who don't pay as much attention to these things tune out and think I can't watch the news because it's so hard. Let's go to Marie in Brockton. Hey, Marie, thanks for calling in. How you doing?
Thank you very much for taking my call. I listen to you all the time. This is where I get my news and my information.
Oh, good.
Only.
We love that, Marie.
So don't, like, because I don't want to hear all the noise. I'm a noise person. First of all, the statement the president made is probably the second statement next to the N-word that is used against people of color.
Yeah.
I'm a family of color. And growing up in Massachusetts, that was heard probably almost every day. I'm older, so every day of my life, I had to hear that. Go back to Africa.
Why don't you go back? Yeah, I mean, that's the part that's sort of astonishing to me. I'm 57
right.
years old. I grew up in the area. I vividly recall
that's
people
right.
yelling
I'm in
to
your
people.
Age range.
Right, go back to
go
Africa.
Go back to Africa.
And the,
right.
the
now,
irony here,
you?
The irony tragedy here, too, is that the people of color here in the United States of America who are the descendants of enslaved people have been here longer. Their ancestors have been here longer
more.
Than almost everybody, the majority of everybody else here.
Or because the enslaved people also had to, would also mix with the Native Americans. A lot of people of color are also Native. So when someone would say, go back to the country you came from, I'd say, I truly am in the country I came from.
So do you think President Trump made this statement via Twitter, this
as
official
statement?
Do you think so?
Because it is so blatant. He could not say the N-word. This is the second closest thing you can say. Truly.
Well, maybe we'll hear that soon, Marie, at the way things are going.
I don't know what I'm rooting for here now, suddenly. I'm like, should we just get him out and get him to say it, or should we just keep talking in these veiled codes?
Hey, Marie, let me ask you, as a person of color, mm-hmm. is this something that almost after so much racism, after so many years, you were inured to, or when it comes to the President of the United States, is this just worse or not? I don't know.
Oh, it's much worse.
It's much worse.
It's
okay.
Scary.
Yeah.
It is absolutely scary. I was here through the whole busing thing, mm-hmm. my family somewhere in Boston. I watched people, the fighting, the horror of it all.
Yeah.
And as I said, when I grew up, I could not walk down the street of my town that I grew up in the same town as my grandmother without hearing those comments, either the N-word or go back to Africa. However, he blatantly knows this is a really fiery word. One thing I did note is that when Epstein was arrested, I went back in my Googled back to when he was running for president because it was something that truly bothered me. And it was the real thing that struck me, like I could no way have this man be the president. And that was the case of Jane Doe, who was 13 years old,
right.
who accused Trump and Epstein of a
Do you
brutal,
remember that, Marjorie?
Horrible...
Yep.
Rape.
And the 13-year-old who's
still not
now,
on the front page. Right.
She's obviously a grown woman now, and she decided
right.
not to press changes. She was represented
because
by...
Because she was terrified, right. and that they had told her that they would kill her and her family.
She was
she didn't
death
withdraw
threats.
Because she said it was false. You can actually see the withdrawal. If you go online, you can read the whole thing, because as it was happening in 2016, I was so sick over it. I thought, no way this monster would get in. But now he is terrified because Epstein is now in the spotlight. And if it goes, and I have not seen it, I'm thinking it's going to be front page news. People will draw it back to the fact.
Well, you're doing it now, Marie.
2016, this woman.
Well,
I wish more people would, because then it would put more of the emphasis on why he's doing what he's doing.
Thank
Marie,
you for calling, Marie.
Thank you very much.
Marie,
thank you very much for that call.
All right, let's go to Jim in the car. Jim, thank you for calling in. What are your thoughts on the president's statements this weekend?
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
You guys have already established that, you know, the three of the congresswomen that he's complaining about are actually from the United States, right? So, but he pluralized countries anyway, suggesting, so already that exposes his racism. You've already, you know, covered that well. On top of that, though, I think it also displays his stupidity that I don't know is talked about enough. Like, we all agree he's a bad guy, whatever. He's also a really stupid guy, and the 25th Amendment stuff gets thrown around a little bit. I kind of wish it was talked about a little more, you know.
Every week he does
another stupid thing.
Your concern is that regardless of the racism aspect of the tweet, the fact that three of the four people he targeted actually are U.S. citizens, and he's designating
right.
and commanding them to go back to their own countries, you think is it even additional concern regarding the president's fitness?
Exactly. Like it reveals both the racist bones, you know, idea, like he's a racist guy, but also he's a stupid guy.
All right, Jim, thanks for calling in. Appreciate it. You know, Marjorie, the 25th Amendment conversation, you know, comes in and comes out from time to time regarding of what's in
well,
the news.
I think the 25th Amendment is
and that
is
would
never
be to remove
happen.
That would be to
yeah.
remove the president
I mean,
from
if
power.
You can't get any Republicans except for Bill Weld to say that it's a problem when the president of the United States. And you do wonder about this going forward. I mean, I'm someone who's voted for Republicans in my life. I don't know what's happened to these Republicans. You know, I guess.
Well, they're getting their agenda. The Republican and conservative. Think of the number of judges that are being put in court.
I know.
I know.
But at the same time, you're getting judges. You have this the racism. You have the anti-women stuff. You have this gruesome stuff that the president is involved with. And when we do get his taxes, I mean, the New York Times basically did it. That he said fraudulent tax returns for decades.
You know, I just want to say one
decades.
Thing. If someone had told me when I was a kid, I just had to say I was a billionaire. I think I would have taken that route instead of actually trying to work for a living.
I guess the thing is, I mean, everybody, I guess you don't want to lose your job, and maybe you love being a congressman, you love being a senator, but at some point you say, at what cost? And where the hell is Mr. Mormon, Mitt Romney?
Senator Mitt Romney.
And where are all these evangelicals who talk about being holy all the time? You know, I'm in that, watching Mike Pence in that pen the other night with all those men in there that don't have room to lie down or the no beds or, you know, sleeping on top of each other. He's running around all the time talking about what a Christian he is.
You know, and the other point,
he should stop
the other
saying
point
that.
that picture that gets missed is that the smell in those places
is stench.
The stench is horrendous, and they keep the temperature down low so the smell isn't so bad. So to go in and experience this and not have. Do we have time for another call?
Yeah, we do.
Let's take one more. Barb from Narragansett, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just am ready to get my Irish passport and get out of here because I don't want to live in Nazi Germany. And I cannot understand how many wrongs does he have to do before he's stopped?
I don't know. I mean, it's strange.
Yeah, we get criticized for covering. I mean, understandable. I'm not sounding like sensitive, but we get criticized for covering and reporting on the things that the president does and his administration does. And then get accused of overkill, of covering too many things and not covering the right things. And it doesn't seem like there's any right approach to do this, to cover the president appropriately, it seems, in a way that the majority of people are either going to pay attention or at least think that the president's being covered fairly and accurately.
But is there not a mechanism within the government to unseat someone who is clearly unfit for the job he's in?
Barb, nearly half of America thinks he's doing a fine job. I mean, that's the bottom line. The Republican Party is silent about the racist remarks he's just made. I get why lots of people are worried about immigration. They're worried about competition in jobs. They're worried about undercutting if you're in a poor town.
See, this is my point, though, too, Marjorie, is that there's a lot of things that the president's administration is paying attention to that I think the United States of America should pay attention to. China, North Korea. But at the same time, I don't have any confidence that they're doing it the right way or in a thoughtful way, even if I disagreed with it. I mean, there have been policies my entire life that I have disagreed with regarding lawmakers and the president. But at least I thought there was a thoughtful approach and a fact-based approach to it. So I'd say, yeah, that's not what I think we should do. But you know, those are smart people, and they've come up with this idea.
Listen, facts and thinking, they're so overrated. You know what I mean, Sue? They're so they're so yesterday. Let's squeeze in one more.
Okay, let's see. We've got Kate from Providence. Hey, Kate, how you doing?
I'm doing well, and I'm calling because, well, Trump is absolutely horrendous. He may not have made a total mistake in turning on the Gang of Four. Nancy Pelosi is way smarter than to say anything about their non-traditional background. But she also is terrified by them because they are very smart young women who come to government with a completely different eye from that of the young and old white people who are mostly government.
So, Kate, do you think Nancy Pelosi was doing sort of the same thing that Trump was doing but didn't cross the line?
I think she is trying to fan some flames against the Gang of Four. And I'm not sure that Trump jumping into that isn't going to push some of the sort of really cowardly Democrats who are out there fearing change into his camp a little bit.
You know, I wonder, Marjorie.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
And I
Kate,
wonder.
Thank you for the call.
Thanks for the call, Kate. I wonder, too, a little bit if this was more of Nancy Pelosi's chess playing, you know, that she criticizes the squad, as they're called,
right,
and expects the president to react and expected him to react in that way. And as Steve Kerrigan made the point earlier in the show, unifies the Democrats in a way that they necessarily weren't on Thursday, right? So here we are on Monday. All the Democrats are sort of like, well, we may not share the values of the squad. We may not be that progressive, but here's a line that the president crossed, where on Thursday, Nancy Pelosi was busy trying to corral her cats. Suddenly, they're all corralled.
I don't know. The machinations of all these people are above my pay grade. I don't know. I just know every day there's another imagination to get all worked up about.
All right. Well, thanks for all of your calls. Sorry to the folks we didn't get to on hold. We're going to take some more calls later in the show on some more fun stuff. Up next, it's time, of course, for All Revved Up with Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. They're next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We are here with the podcast Tears, podcast of Tears. I'm Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. They're in Studio 3 to take on the moral dilemmas of the day. And congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
On your podcast.
Thank you.
Called All Revved Up.
And
when's the next one?
Revved Up.
Okay. July 10th.
July 10th. Okay.
No, I'm sorry.
That was the launch.
That was the launch date, Emmett. That's all right.
It was the 21st. 24th.
Yeah.
Revved Up.
Irene is a syndicated religion columnist. columnist, the Boston voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail, and a visiting professor in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Department at the BU School of Theology. Emmett G. Price III is a professor and founding executive director for the Institute of the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. And as I just said, they have a new podcast. It's called All Revved Up. You can get it wherever you get your podcast.
Yeah,
I just get mine.
Thank you.
Yeah, if you don't know where to get a podcast by now, just, you know, give it up.
I'm glad to see my editor today.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. I expect your column on deadline. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
I'm going to do my best, yes.
So I just want to get back for a second to what we just talked about with our listeners, which is the racist tweet from the president, tweets from the president going after four women of color that are in Congress, telling them to go back to where they came from. Obviously, this is a racist, outrageous thing. He's done so many racist, outrageous things. But I wonder, is he doing this because he thinks half of America is going to be okay with this because half of America is racist? And or is there a method to his madness? Or is this just another Twitter storm at 6 o'clock in the morning? What do you think, Emma?
Well, I'm not interested in why he did this and what he did. I'm interested in saying that I'm extremely proud of Congresswoman Omar and Presley and Tlaib and Alexandria Cortez, and that's as an independent. I'm not a Democrat. I tend to vote Democratic, and so I'm not focused on Trump. I'm not focused on Lindsey Graham, who doubled down on the statement on Fox and Friends earlier today. But it's interesting that I'm going to side with British Prime Minister Theresa May, who actually, you know, said, "What is he doing? Why is he doing this?" And I'm also going to side with a white male congressman, a Democrat from Connecticut, Jim Himes, who said, "I actually am a foreign-born member of Congress, but I'm a white male of European descent, so there's no chance he'll attack me."
Oh, that's right.
There's a point that Emma made. We had a caller that came in, and I'm certainly old enough, and I'm certain it still happens. This is such like an old-school racist taunt as well. I'm not sure that you hear it as often as you used to when we were all growing up. And while I'm sure it has been said to people who were not of color, you know, go back to where you came from.
That's right.
It has primarily, in my experience, that I have seen it been used and heard people use it, directed at people of color, because I've always noted it because even when I was a little kid, I'd be like, do you know that they didn't come here by choice? Like, by saying, go back to where you came from.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's one of those racist tropes. It has really a number of, you know, historical antecedents, because before we had a large immigration population, what folks would say to me and to African Americans was the whole idea, and particularly during the civil rights movement, would be go back to Africa. So that's a racist
and
trope.
And plus your identity. The other part of it, which I think gets lost in this, it's not racism. It's just anti-immigration or anti-alien.
Oh, no.
Is that you can't always recognize white people who come from other countries, right?
When I used to get the trope growing up in California, and you know, I'm not that old, I would say to the people who said it, I see you there.
Yeah. Well, you know, you know what gets me about that, though? It's
that's
what,
a good one.
If we're saying that America is a country of immigrations, what we realize then all of us come on some sort of boat, and that really it's this land belongs to Native Americans. But I want to say this here. I'm troubled by not only the appalling silence of the Republican Party around this, but there were 90,000 tweets, 90,000 that absolutely liked it. But what bothers me about this, they said, well, he didn't say their name. There are a couple of reasons why he didn't say his name. Let's be honest. He can't pronounce his names here. But I'm always reminded about this notion that your silence will not protect you, because it's the whole idea that we know this well-known statement that, you know, when they came for the unionists, okay, I wasn't
right, right,
one.
Right.
You know, and then they go down the list. They say communists, the Jews, and then they say they came for me.
And nobody was here. Just want to report that on CNN just now, President Trump addressed the issue and said, quote, "All I'm saying is if they want to leave, they can leave. If these people get their hands on government, everything we have, all our values, will go down the tube."
And see, well, what's interesting about this, again, politics aside, as a father, how do I process and parse this with my children, who I'm trying to teach to be responsible citizens, who I'm trying to teach to be good, you know, quote unquote, patriots, to love their nation,
right,
when from the highest office of the land, this vitriol and this foolishness comes out, and the American people. So I've had to say to some of my friends who I know are Republicans, I don't care who you vote for. I don't care who you support. But don't ever call yourself my friend if you don't try to keep my children and my family safe.
Yeah, and I think what bothers me speaking about that, because we do have black Republican friends and we do have Latino public. Where are they on this issue? And that's the appalling silence that also bothers me. I think it also bothers me in this way, because we've been hearing a kind of anti-Latino kind of rhetoric from the beginning when he says Mexicans will,
rapists,
you know,
are rapists,
but also pay for the border,
yep,
and also MS-13. And then he went on talking about Puerto Rico. Where's the Cuban community on this? Do they not see that they're included in that rubric of anti-Latino rhetoric? It just bothers me why they're also quiet about this.
You know, you mentioned before Emmett Price, you mentioned Ayanna Pressley, the newly elected congresswoman from Boston. She did take – this is what her response was to the president. This is what racism looks like. We are what democracy looks like. We're not going anywhere except back to D.C. to fight for the families you marginalize and vilify every day. That was to Trump. When she was asked – I think it was on Jim's show, but I forget where I saw this – her reaction to Nancy Pelosi, mm-hmm, singling them out as you're four women, you got four votes. She took the high road again. She didn't want to – engage. And I thought her responses to this, as you said, have been very impressive.
And measured. Very measured.
Very measured.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
She is if she's a junior stateswoman, she's a senior stateswoman.
Yeah.
Because she is staying on the
message.
Reason why people elected her.
Right.
To represent her district, to represent the people who voted for her. And I think the other three women of the quote-unquote squad are doing the same thing. They got elected, and they're representing their folks. So to be disrupted, to have an obstacle of having to respond to the president every, you know, morning when he gets up or whatever, you know, it's nonsense, because the American people can see what's going on. And again, if this is a country, and if this is the way that the country should function based on the people, then they should vote how they should vote.
But I am proud of
these four for standing up and being who they are and not backing down.
Right, and speaking for their constituents.
But I mean, again, this is also the burden of being the perfect minority, the perfect oppressed, you know, that you can't just hit back the way you might want to, you know, you might want to hit back verbally about being attacked. You have to rise above it in order to just be the status quo almost.
Yeah, but I think, you know, it's very interesting when we look at Ayanna Pressley in particular. And not only is she staying on message, I mean, it's like she said, I mean, if you grow up, we've grown up in America, we begin to understand that this is his strategy of distraction, you know. And so if you continue to answer every tweet or respond to every, you know, sort of misstep that he makes, or if he misspeaks, I never think he misspeaks, I think he's very intentional, you will never get anything done here. You will continue to just be off message. I think what we need to do, and I think that this is the part that I'm trying to figure out here, the movable middle. I'm concerned about the moderate and the folks who are centrist, because the folks who voted for Obama the first time and then went back to and voted for Donald, I think that those are the people. How do we message to them to come on board and help us have this multicultural democracy that very much exists?
You know what? You just mentioned something very interesting, Emmett, about teaching your children to be patriotic Americans. And since you're both black Americans and you're two gay women here, it is a hard time.
And I have an immigrant child. My child wasn't
That's
born
right.
here. My
you
child's
an immigrant. Child.
My child's a brown immigrant.
So how do you navigate? You know, how do you tell, especially, I don't know how old your kids are, but teenagers, okay, the worst possible.
I mean, Marjorie, imagine, I had my child make a copy of her passport to carry with her while she's out and about in Boston.
Is that right?
Yeah, because
that's
she,
crazy.
You know, so that if, you know, if asked where she was born and she says, I wasn't born in the U.S., she would not be swept up in something because she might not have the developmental capacity.
But why would someone make the assumption that she's not born here? Particularly, I just need to say this, we have a large Asian.
Right, but she doesn't necessarily look Asian, right? She has been mistaken for being Hispanic. She has been mistaken. She doesn't necessarily fit
that
like you would look at her immediately and say that she was Asian. But either way, just because she was not born here, I have her carry her passport. Can you imagine telling your kids that they to have ID on them at all time in case they get swept up in something and don't have the developmental capacity to explain where you're from and why you're here? I mean, this is the part that I think people don't. And that's a great question you ask, because I don't think people understand this. The day after Trump was elected, the kids at my daughter's Boston Public School walked their classmates who were wearing hijabs to the train station as a group on their own and walked other kids who weren't sure of their parents' status, weren't sure of their own status because they're kids, they're teenagers. And when I said that to a Republican spokesperson, that happened, he told me it didn't happen. He said, no, that isn't happening. I said, no, but it actually happened, that people who are feeling vulnerable in this country.
But this happened long before this moment, because when we had 9/11, my good friend, who is Sikh, was jumped in Harvard Square because they thought he was a Muslim.
But at least had a president who tried then, who said, we are not at war with Islam, and he went to visit the mosque.
I mean, think of Bush.
Now we have something else. So what do you say to the teenagers?
I try to teach them, one, the whole story about peer pressure, right? Because the way peer pressure works is by these jokes that are racist and xenophobic jokes. Don't participate in those things. As a matter of fact, you be the one to stand up for the person who's getting talked about and picked on, so we can learn morals and values, so that we understand that just because somebody's in the highest office doesn't make them the smartest or the brightest person. It doesn't even make them the most important person, because the way that the American democracy works is actually about the least of these,
which
is a Christian, you know, a principle. So it's about those who don't have, who have opportunity to get and to attain and to be helped and to turn around and help others with what they have. And so how do we see the importance of relationships so that we can be in relationship with one another, to be a part of this society?
But this is something particular that Emmett would have to tell his sons, whether no matter who was president, because if you grow up as African American or black in this society, you got to understand that all the laws are not just laws, and all the people who are standing and upholding these laws are necessarily good people.
Well, I'll say that if anybody ever doubted that, now I think we're pretty clear. I said earlier that one of the things that these tweets and statements from the president kind of make clear is that you get to know where everybody's standing.
Yes.
There's no question about that. I want to talk about Maureen Dowd and her New York Times editorial, which I have to say was a very pithy and fun little headline, The Scaling Wokeback Mountain.
I thought that was great.
Where she is critical of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, one of the squad, representative out of New York, and is basically criticizing or saying that AOC is making it all about herself rather than about the mission or the cause. I don't know how I feel about this, because I wonder if I read it and the president didn't tweet what he tweeted, I'd be like, well, maybe she has a point. But today I'm like,
I like Dal's article for a lot of reasons here, because we begin to see the ideological and generational divide here. What they're trying to do, I was calling them the Mod Squad, so this really dates me here back in the day. What they really are trying to do is push the boundaries. It's really push the boundaries that have so long taken not only, you know, black votes for granted, but taking other people of color, other communities of color, their votes for granted. We're as black women, we're tired of being the backbone of the Democratic Party and seeing nothing out of it. And we also have an old guard, an old black guard that wants the status quo too. So here is this younger generation that is saying it's not either or; it can be this and that. And that's the thing that I feel like Nancy got to embrace. It's not one way to do this. We can move together with these various voices, and they don't have to be dissident.
You know, I was struck by this, Em, because I can only imagine if Maureen Dowd were writing editorials when Martin Luther King, Reverend Martin Luther King was touring the country trying to talk to people, to lift people up. And sometimes you have to inspire, you have to be the mountain.
You have to be humble.
Okay.
You have to be vulnerable, and you have to allow people to associate with the fact that this is not just a power play or a title or you know, something in that realm. This is about people. And I love her response to couple of weeks ago, folks were basically saying, you know, why don't you go back to waitressing, you know, because you have shared your story about being a waitress and whatnot. And she says, well, you know, that's not a slander. That's not bad. But did you also forget that I graduated from college and I was an awardee and that I had a fellowship and I had all these, you know, different accolades and accomplishments? Did you forget about all that stuff? If you only see me as a Latina, waitress, yeah.
You know, the thing is, though, what we have to address here, and I don't know how we can tamp this down, is that I think Nancy and I think an older generation in particularly is operating not only being reactionary, but also out of fear. And I think that we all are fearful. How do we get Trump out of office? And I think that's why we were upset about, you know, certainly Kamala Harris, you know, pushing back on Biden. But the point is that we won't know what we stand for until we air out these various differences so that we can have a DNC platform of what we all stand for and everybody feel that they're part of it. Because as it is now, that there'll be certain groups that feel like the DNC platform, you know, is intentionally leaving them out.
Right, but
it's
can they hold their
better.
Nose and vote like the Republicans and the conservatives have voted for Donald Trump?
No.
I mean,
no, we can't. We've always taken the higher ground, the higher moral ground.
You know, I just thought of this. This isn't on the script here, but I Friday night when we were seeing the pictures of the camps mm-hmm. on the border, the yeah. cages, and you saw, I don't know, 400 mm-hmm. some men in those cages, and they didn't have beds and stuff. And I thought of Mike Pence, who wears his faith on his sleeve, who says he's a man of faith first, and I think the United States is second, and I don't know, his wife is third. I don't know the exact order, but anyway, he's like Mr. Holy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you're a minister. You're a minister. Mm-hmm. How can he say, I think fine?
I think there's two reasons here. One of the things is we're so partisan. What we needed really is have some Republicans as well as as Democrats go to these camps together, and so that we all see
they're
these.
Not gonna do that,
but I'm just saying this because of course he's going to give a counter narrative here, and what he is saying, what Pence is saying, is this: we are providing the most humanitarian funds and aids and conditions to these detainees. But what he has to understand is a cage is a cage. These people are still in a cage.
I mean, Evan, Marjorie,
when you take goldfish that have always been in a goldfish aquarium, now remember, so you can't mix and match certain fish because some need fresh water, some need salty water, and some are predators, and the goldfish will get eaten up. But when he operates as a goldfish. He's always in his bubble. His talk points are in his bubble. His dog whistles are in his bubbles, and he is a standard bearer of a certain stream of white evangelicalism, and he believes what he believes because there is no absolute truth that can counter that.
That's
the problem
right.
is that when he sees the truth up front, he doesn't have the language. He doesn't have the
talk points
to be able to go around.
No, he doesn't have the balls to really stand and say, look here, that this is he can't tell the truth if he's on point here. But what I want to say here about the Mod Squad, as I call them, is that I appreciate that what they're saying is that even though you will throw some humanitarian money and aids and all this to these detainees here, the system is fundamentally broken.
Yeah.
And so what you're doing is a Band-Aid approach as opposed to systemically, this needs to be revamped. And that's part of why they disagreed with Nancy Pelosi. And so what bothers me about it is that they feel that this group is being oppositional just to be oppositional.
All
and
right, that's the
it.
Reverend Irene Monroe
yeah.
along
and
with
congratulations
Emmett
again
Thanks so much.
On the podcast.
Appreciate
I loved
your support.
It.
Here every Monday
yeah,
for All Revved Up. Irene Monroe is a syndicated religious columnist, Emmett Price, professor and founding executive director of the Institute for Study of the Black Christian Experience. Remember, you can find All Revved Up over wherever you get your podcasts. GBH science correspondent Heather Goldstone is up next to go over the latest science and environmental headlines. Up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Sue O'Connell from Bay Windows and New England Cable News is filling in today for Jim Browdy, who has the day off. Joining us on the line to go over the latest headlines at the intersection of science, policy, and society is WGBH science correspondent Heather Goldstone, an expert on ocean science and host of the Living Lab Radio, which you can catch Sundays at noon right here on 89.7 WGBH. Whoops. No, that's correct. That's right. Correct. That's correct. Just make sure you didn't goof that up. 89.7. Yeah, that is where I work.
Yeah, that's WGBH. Where you work today. Yes.
That is
that's
correct.
Good job.
And on Mondays at 9 a.m. and 7 p.m., that's the one that's on WCAI 90.1 down the Cape. Heather, thank you very much for being here.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Well, I want to start with this headline that made me so depressed in the New York Times, where it talked about this latest hurricane to strike New Orleans. It said, Hurricane Barry and the New Normal. Why did they call it the new normal?
Well, I mean, like you said, that was kind of a tough piece. It was, I think, in the opinion section, it was kind of a first-person account of one person's experience of deciding whether to stay or leave New Orleans as Barry was approaching, and the things that ended up being considerations that he would never previously have thought of, like, if we leave and we're in another state and my wife, who is, you know, very near the end of a pregnancy, ends up delivering a baby in another state, will our insurance cover it? And I thought what was really spot on about that piece is we've heard the phrase the new normal referring to actual weather conditions, but he seemed to be using the new normal to refer to a state of mind and a psychological condition.
And Heather, the challenge there, too, is just it's so hard to get people to pay attention to the dangers that might happen from where we live or what we do, just basic climate stuff. But now we're experiencing, you know, in California, all these fires all the time, which are the new normal. We're experiencing more intense storms because of the warmer oceans, which are the new normal. And sharks that are here because of the seals, which are the new normal. I mean, how?
And down the Cape,
yes.
All these lakes and ponds that were shut down, no swimming, 4th of July, and continuing because of the cyanobacteria, Heather, that is some stories I've said have been linked to not just people's cesspools and chemicals on their lawn, but also to the massive rainstorms which created this unprecedented runoff.
So how do you connect with people to try and get them to pay attention and take action about these things?
Well, I think that challenge has been here for a long time,
yep.
and has gotten actually, unfortunately, a lot easier because people don't necessarily need journalists to be connecting the dots for them anymore. The impacts of climate change, and just one quick thing, sharks are not a climate change
effect. Thank you.
Just want to make sure that's clear.
Yeah, yeah.
But climate change does intersect with our daily lives in so many ways, and the effects are becoming a daily part of life for a lot of people, and it's becoming hard to ignore it and not connect the dots. And I think, you know, another thing to note with the new normal, and I think that's the other thing that kind of framing this as a psychological new normal and thinking about the uncertainty that comes into play when you start thinking about the way that climate change interacts with our lives is the fact that if you talk to climate scientists, their only problem with this phrase, the new normal, when we're talking about extreme weather and weather conditions, is that it's not going to stay this way, right? The new normal is constant change. That's what the new normal really is. The new normal is not just a bad fire season, or that every fire season in California or every year is going to be that way, or that every hurricane is going to be like Harvey was, or Florence was, or Barry was. It's that things are going to constantly keep changing at this point.
Which makes it even more difficult to plan.
Right, it does. And I think that to me is what that piece in the New York Times really drove home, is the realizing that when there's this much uncertainty and this much rapid change, and when things are so different than they have been, you know, when we were growing up, it creates a lot of psychological uncertainty as well. And the other thing that I kind of got out of that piece is he talks about the way a bunch of different neighbors and people that he, you know, whose stories he saw on social media and all the different steps they were taking to prepare for Barry. And I just thought, oh, my gosh, we're becoming an entire nation of preppers. I actually interviewed an anthropologist who studies preppers earlier this year, and he was saying, you know, most preppers, it's not actually prepping for doomsday, for the apocalypse. They just really are people who want to be prepared. And I think increasingly we're all realizing that we have vulnerabilities as a result of climate change, whether that's the fact that what federal officials came out with a report last week highlighting the fact that 2018, we saw a record number of days of high tide flooding, which is like there's no storm in sight. It's a, you know, perfectly beautiful day. And yet we're seeing coastal flooding just because of sea level rise. High tide is high enough to flood roads or yards or whatever is there. You know, we're starting to see these impacts on a chronic day to day basis, not just with one time big storms like Katrina or Maria, but on a daily basis, and it's becoming a lot harder for a lot of people to ignore.
Yeah, I want to transition to the story you have over at the Living Lab radio regarding the headlines, like politics, all sea level rise is local. And this fascinates me because I have a lot of friends and family who live on the coast and live in towns and cities that are along the ocean. And when I talk about climate change, some of them say to me, listen, I go down to the yacht club every week and there's a high tide watermark and we haven't hit it yet. So I'm not really sure what you think this climate change is all about. There's a lot that's misunderstood around that, right?
There is. And certainly something like sea level rise, even to hear a scientist say that it's happening very rapidly, you have to, you know, consider what are the terms of sea level rise happening very rapidly. And when the tide goes up by 3 feet or in some places 5 or 10 feet up and down every single day to see an increase of a foot over a century, right, seems really minor. And it's the same thing with temperatures, right? We see the temperature go up and down 10, 15 degrees from morning to mid-afternoon on a lot of days. And so to say, oh, we're looking at, you know, a 2-degree increase in average global temperatures, I think it's easy for people to go, well, why does that matter, right? And it's realizing that when we say these trends that are, you know, the overall increase in the height of the sea, or when we were talking about the overall increase in temperature, one climate scientist said to me a few years ago, and it's like the sea level rise, all sea level is local, all weather is local. Nobody lives a global average temperature. We all right. live our daily local, very local conditions. And so one of the challenges in communicating about climate change, and, you know, this has led to people saying, oh, well, maybe we should be using different words. We should call it climate disruption or climate chaos or something like that, because even change kind of has this linear, steady connotation to it, when in fact what we're seeing is kind of bouncing between extremes in a lot of cases, and seeing those longer trends is harder. What we feel are those daily extremes. We feel, you know, what was it, 3.5 inches of rain in D.C. last Monday that flooded there. You know, the fact that New Orleans had already flooded before Barry got there from an extreme rain event earlier in the week. Those are the things that we're seeing. And increasingly, science can make the links for us between what's happening on a daily basis. We're no longer stuck saying, oh, well, you know, we can't attribute or link any one weather event to climate change. And instead, we can say blanket statement, climate change is affecting all of our weather every single day. It's the background on which our weather happens. But we also now have scientifically the ability to go back. And for that matter, like by the first week of July, scientists had already looked at the extreme heat in Europe at the end of June. I don't know if any of you guys are soccer fanatics the way my household are, right? Watching women playing the World Cup in 90 degree heat. And had already looked at that like by a week later and said, we can run our computer models with or without climate change, kind of run a simulation of this event and say that that extreme heat was 5 times more likely because of climate change. So we're to the point with the science where we can start to draw these links, not just to the big global trends, but to local daily events and start to really connect those dots.
You know, I saw the pictures in Washington, D.C. of the flooding down there, and you saw these commuters that were standing on the roofs of their cars or kneeling on the roofs of their cars because their cars were like 4 feet underwater. I keep hoping, I hope there's a few politicians in there that are in denial about this whole thing, because, boy, I mean, that's what's so unusual is you see things that have never happened before.
Well, that's the hard. It's so hard to make this point. Some folks will say, well, that's because we have so much media now. And I'm like, no, we used to have books and newspapers. these papers back in the last couple of centuries, too, you know?
Yeah. There's definitely things that are changing, and there's a different challenge with the extreme weather events where people can kind of write it off and say, oh, but we've always had hurricanes, and we've always had flooding, we've always had extreme events. And the point is, yes, we have, but now they're more extreme, and they are in many cases, more frequent. In the case of heat waves, they also tend to last longer, right? And so they are different, and we do now have the ability with the science to start putting some numbers to that.
Heather Goldstone, you wrote a piece about a racial disparity in terms of heat waves in New York City. Tell us.
Well, and it's not just New York City. It's really, you know, probably if you look at it more broadly, it is a socioeconomic disparity. But of course, in the United States, those two things are intimately linked because of the long history of racism. And so if you look at individual heat wave events in the United States, very frequently what you will see is, in the case of New York City, it was higher death rates from heat waves, heat-related death rates among African Americans. Similarly, the Chicago heat wave of 1995, looking into that, a much higher death rate among African Americans. And scientists who have looked into this said probably, you know, if you look at what is immediately causing those deaths, it's things like pre-existing conditions, cardiovascular disease or kidney disease that makes it harder to handle the heat. It's also socioeconomic and social and cultural factors like, do people have air conditioning? Do they have the funds to turn the air conditioner on? Do they feel safe opening a window? Do they have places accessible to them if their home can't be cooled, where they could get to a public space that might be cooled? You know, all of these things that are tied into, in the end, you can go neighborhood by neighborhood through major cities and see major disparities in who dies as a result of heat waves. And often that ends up falling along socioeconomic and racial lines.
And Heather, I know that the issue of air conditioning is complex and complicated, but we tend to forget, it's sort of like the flu epidemic, we tend to forget how many people, even before climate change, would die due to heat-related issues before we were able to effectively cool ourselves.
Right, absolutely. You know? I mean, and still, it's one of those things where we're able, the things that happen kind of, we pay more attention to the big catastrophic one-off events, right? And so we tend to overlook the fact that among all of the weather-related disasters, heat is actually the biggest killer in the United States. Kills more people than hurricanes or, you know, any of these other things that we get much more ramped up about in terms of media coverage or people feeling scared about. And that can actually factor into people dying, because if we misestimate the risk and don't realize how deadly the heat can be, don't realize that perhaps, you know, a person might not realize that, oh, I have a condition that would make me more susceptible to dying because of the heat, then, you know, that's when you start to have real problems. And another major factor is also just social isolation, right? Especially if you've got elderly individuals or perhaps one scientist was highlighting that, you know, in fact, in immigrant communities, right, if you've got an issue of isolation where you don't feel like you can reach out for help, those people are at higher risk of dying during a heat wave.
Heather, we've got about 2 minutes left, but before you go, can you tell us what's going on with these lawsuits involving climate change?
Yeah, this was a recent analysis by some researchers in the UK, and they just looked at how many climate-related lawsuits there have been in the past close to 30 years. And it was, to me, a shockingly huge number. There are a handful that have made big headlines here in the U.S., but it turns out there have been over 1,000 climate-related lawsuits filed in the U.S. I think it was over 1,500 worldwide. We're seeing an increase in these. And it comes back to that scientific ability to link specific events to climate change. That's one of the major scientific underpinnings of a lot of these cases, people going in and saying, look, we're seeing the effects. We can link it to climate change. And it's often governments who are being sued for either failing to meet their existing standards and laws or for failing in the eyes of the plaintiffs to have strong enough laws. So it's an interesting just kind of reality check on a tool that we've seen become a more and more important tool in climate policy and the climate debate. But to realize just how many climate lawsuits there really are that are out there. And I should say the vast majority of those are people who are saying, you know, the plaintiffs are saying we need more action. The number of people going to court to block climate action is much smaller.
All right, Heather Goldstone.
Heather, thank you.
Thanks so much. Good to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Heather is GBH's science correspondent, an expert in ocean science, and the host of Living Lab Radio, which you can catch Sundays at noon right here on 89.7 and Mondays at 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. on WCAI 90.1. Up next, we're going to open the phone lines again and ask you if you think it might be in your best interest to raise your kid to be a capitalist. Stay tuned.
Yes. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim is a day off, and Sue O'Connell is filling in. So, if you're a parent worried about how you pay for that college tuition and save enough for retirement, is grooming your kid to be a billionaire the answer? If you think so, there's a camp for that. There's a growing number of parents enrolling their kids in workshops and sleepaway trips that focus on stimulating the entrepreneurial mindset, enlightening youth about the importance of innovation, and imbuing the next generation with an appreciation for surplus value.
I love it.
Is this a good thing? Should we forget about tennis camp, Girl Scout camp, how to build a campfire, gut a fish, make a lanyard? Should we forget about that? Should we forget about soccer camp and just go right for the bucks? 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970.
So I'll tell you, we were once on our way to Disney when my kid was, I think, 5 or 6, and we were planning our Disney trip, and I was explaining to her, you know, there's lots of things you're going to want to buy. It would be great if you could find a way to raise some money, you know, so that you can buy these things, trying to teach her a good example. And she said, well, is there anything in the house we can sell? And you know how you get all these candles for the holidays, for Christmas and stuff?
Like, absolutely.
I hate candles.
You don't like candles?
I hate candles. Okay. So we gathered up all the candles that I had been given, right, for gifts over the years. And we went door to door in our little neighborhood in Canton, and she sold the candles like for $1 or $2 raise money. So I thought this was a good example. So we get home and I see her and she's just looking out the window. And I said, what are you looking at? She said, there's a lot of money out there.
There you go.
Now, unfortunately, the lesson that you can go out and get the money hasn't really transferred. Mm-hmm. But the idea that there's, you know, we talk about it as capitalism, but it's also just about business and about knowing your worth and knowing that there are things to buy and sell. And we spend a lot of time sending them to camp singing Kumbaya.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. I mean, really, when you think about it, you know, your kid is probably not going to wind up in the NFL, the NBA, the Major League Baseball. They're not going to be one of the women on the women's soccer team fighting to get fair pay. They're probably going to cost you tons of money. Shouldn't one of them, or, you know, if you got two kids or if you got one, I mean, I think there's an obligation to help support your parents in your old age. And I'm sorry I made a big mistake. I should have not had the baseball camp. I should have sent them to Little Koch Brothers capitalist camp so they could understand, they can get tours of the Federal Reserve.
There you go.
They get tours of Starbucks. They can figure out how to create their business ideation and craft their pitch.
Of course, the problem with this is that only mostly white kids are going to be able to go to that. So, you know, and kids of a certain economic status. So I think we need to expand it through the Ys. We need
Absolutely.
To expand it. That it's also important, you know, I don't know growing up in the 60s and 70s in gritty Revere if I understood how many different career paths there were. I mean, I had a friend, one of my dearest friend growing up, he went to college and majored in political science. And when he told me he was going to study political science, I had no idea what it was.
Exactly.
No idea.
Exactly.
So imagine if I knew that you could work on Wall Street. Where would I be today, Marjorie? Where would I be?
Well, Art is thinking along the way I am. He says, should you teach your kids to be good capitalists? Depends. Do you want them to be able to support you in your old age, or do you still want to be supporting them? And I think that's really the bottom line question.
877-301-8970. Let's go to Paul in Worcester, who is joining us. Paul, are you raising your children to be moral capitalists?
Hello, ladies. They are actually, my children are very much moral capitalists.
Well, that's good. Better than being an immoral capitalist.
No, they're extremely moral. They're great. Marjorie, you might remember I'm a cash flow, budget, and savings guy.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That's right.
And so my kids have, they're 20 and 21 and 23, and they have, if they're on target by the time they're my age, at 60, they'll have millions and millions of dollars. Now, it may not be worth that much, but it'll still be a lot of millions.
Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute. So are they doing this through their brilliance in business, or are they saving their money? Or are they doing the 401k?
They're everything. Everything they can.
Good for them.
Are they oriented that way? Because I asked that, Paul, because I like that. I'm really good with like my business money, like in the businesses that I own. I'm really good at projecting and budgeting. But when it comes to my own stuff, it's just like an unmade bed, basically.
They haven't done a whole lot on their own in business yet because they're still pretty young. But
right.
Their own stuff, no, they got it nailed.
Okay, well, good for them.
They're also really, really great kids.
Do any of them want to marry my kid? Because that might work out well for me. Because that's the other thing you can do is marry into.
Well, one of our emailers just said, this is from Stephen. He says, I didn't raise my kid to be a capitalist. I raised my kid to marry a capitalist.
All right, Paul, thanks for calling
you.
In.
That's a good move. Have a kid marry a capitalist. Listen to this. They have these kids at the camps for kids as young as 8 years old. Learn how to monetize their hobbies, interview local corporate executives, shoot YouTube commercials for their own prospective businesses. How about that?
All right. Let's talk to Valerie in Boston. Valerie, thanks for calling in. How are your kids doing?
They're great. They're great. They're not entrepreneurs, though.
Oh, wow.
They're enjoying their summer, not working that hard. But my point was, I don't see how this is any different than our society. Currently, all the kids are doing soccer camp, but they're doing soccer camp so they can pay for college.
Exactly.
They're doing all these camps so they can get the scholarship. So I don't see how this is any different than what we're doing now.
You know, it's a great point, Valerie. And then you get to the moment when you get the scholarship and you realize you might get a nice sports scholarship. Well, maybe if you're like a first string NFL
prospect, but you can get
a scholarship of $40,000, but you still have to pay another $30,000.
So right.
It's like, not, it's like, oh, it doesn't cover everything. I didn't know that.
Well, I do. I often think we spend as a society a lot of time educating the kids, those of us who have the privilege to be able to do that. But we don't seem to be teaching them the things. Like, I think there should be a climate crisis camp.
That's a good idea.
You know, I'm so worried that our kids are going to be 70 years old and looking at us and saying, why were you sending us to soccer camp when the earth was burning? I mean, you know, but we won't be here, so I guess we won't have to worry about that.
Valerie, that was a great point. We do all send our kids to all these little sporting camps, hoping they're good. And as this piece points out, and by the way, this is off a story called Capitalism Camp for Kids. It was from the New York Times
It was in May, but it still keeps giving.
Well, I remember seeing it when I first saw it in the paper. At first I thought, this is disgusting. And then I thought, maybe not. Maybe I should rethink this. But this piece does point out that Girl Scouts have been doing this, in a sense, for many years. They have 31 entrepreneurship-related badges having to do with, of course, Girl Scouts and Girl Scouts cookies. And their fourth graders can earn cookie CEO badges, although they have to wait apparently a couple to sixth grade and learn about financing my dreams or getting marketing patches and stuff. But the Girl Scouts have always been big.
They've been doing it, selling the cookies.
Girl Scout cookies, right?
877-301-8970 if you want to join the conversation and talk about sending your kid to capitalism camp. Hey, Carl from Boston, what's going on in your household?
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Carl.
Hi. Hey, Marjorie, it's Carl, your friend who loves your last.
Oh, Carl, thank you very much. Carl, anytime.
Hey, Marge, can I ask you a quick question, and then I'll get into the climate wire?
Well, it depends on what it is, Carl. What's the question?
Well, did you know that you made Radio Boston?
Did I made what?
You know, there's a website called Dirty Old Boston.
Oh, Dirty Old Boston,
oh,
all
Dirty
the great
Old
photos.
Boston. Oh, yeah, I think they interviewed me for that about covering, I don't remember.
Covering Dirty Old Boston.
Covering Dirty Old Boston. Yeah, the Herald was right near the combat zone back in the day when the combat zone was still there. So I guess I walked through Dirty Old Boston every day.
Oh, okay. No, they had an article about, they showed J.J. Foley. Mm-hmm. And there was a picture of the bar that was down on, I guess in those days, Dover Street. And it just said, one of the places that Marjorie Egan used to hang in.
That's right.
That's true.
That's right.
Back
so what do you think about the capitalism camps, Carl?
Okay. So getting into that, I just watched a documentary yesterday called Generational Wealth.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what? Watching that is an eye-opener. Of all what people do to make money, how they're just geared up And then when they fall from grace and they've lost it all, they look back on it and just say, you know, time spent with family and friends is what really matters.
Yeah, it's true, except that when you're living it, not looking, you know, the abyss in the eye, you think that you need more, more, more. You know, that's always the challenge that that we have as humanity.
Absolutely. But what I got out of that was that a lot of people left the rat race because they said it wasn't worth it. You don't need all that much. How America is just geared up to make you think you need that because more is better. And, you know, the more you have, you need even bigger and better. And it doesn't really mean that at all.
All right, Carl, thanks
thank
for calling in.
Thank you very much for the
talk
call.
Talk with you soon.
Robert says, my parents were true hippies, and then when he was 7 or 8, he went away to hobo summer camp. To this day, I have no desires for excess material goods, and I'm happy as a clam. So
all
there
right,
you go.
There you go. VC from Hyde Park is calling us. Hey, VC, how you doing?
Okay, baby, how you doing?
I'm doing all right.
I love you ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Behaving yourself. I don't have to come down there. And have
I wish I weren't behaving
I
myself.
Know. We could be a little better.
All right.
So
okay,
what's up?
When my daughters were 4 and 7, we had a little flea market on the front porch selling their toys and their books, and they made some money. They had some neighbors come up and help them out. And the neighbor girls thought that they should get paid, but my daughter said, no, you didn't bring any books or toys.
And how are your daughters doing with money now? How do they do?
Okay, now what they're doing now, they're grown, they're married, they have their own children. They pay their bills. They know how to maneuver their finances. And they're very good at accounting.
Very all right, good job, VC.
And they're passing it on to their children. But that doesn't mean that we didn't play the piano. We didn't have ballet.
Right.
We didn't play tennis. We didn't go ice skating. We had too much fun.
It's all about all the balance. All right, VC, thanks
thank
for calling
you.
In. Appreciate it.
Thank you
it.
Very much for the call.
Well-rounded. Remember having a well-rounded childhood? Remember those days before
yeah.
you became a soccer expert or a... Oh, chess
yeah.
expert.
You know, they talk about how at this one place called Connect Camp, this is for you're not 8 years old in this camp, apparently you're at least a preteen, and it's run down in Florida. So that's the place where they take you for tours of the Federal Reserve. But they also break up the day, I guess, with stints on rope courses and other exercises.
Well, they are kids.
Yes, and but they want them to remember that during lunchtime, it's very important to network with their fellow campers. Because you know, you may be sitting there next to Warren Buffett,
you never know.
At 7 years old. And so it's good to get on top of that situation.
877-301-8970 is the number to dial. If you want to join our conversation about capitalism camp for kids, good idea, bad idea, or just an idea. Rachel from Cambridge is joining us. Hey, Rachel, how are you?
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call.
Absolutely.
Well, I do listen, and I was really interested to hear about this conversation about capitalism camp. It sounds rather, questionable, but it's probably a good idea to be. We need to be informed. I mean, we live in a capitalist country. We should know what it's all about. And, so I'd really like people to think about today and tomorrow is Amazon Prime Day. In terms of capitalism, we need to understand Amazon. It's a huge phenomenon in our system. And today is Amazon Prime Day, and we are asking people to boycott today and tomorrow both the stores like Whole Foods and online shopping.
Are you an Amazon?
Because there are people.
Are you an Amazon employee,
Rachel?
No,
I'm not. I am a member of the community. Mm-hmm. I'm very, very concerned about workers. And the workers at the Amazon in Minneapolis are on strike because of terrible working conditions. And, really bad working conditions. So we actually had a picket line in Jamaica Plain. A lot of people decided not to shop at Whole Foods because we said you're crossing a picket line, and if you're with the workers, you won't shop here. So I think understanding capitalism, we need to understand what is a boycott, what is a picket line, what is solidarity with workers. That's also a big part of capitalism.
It is a challenge.
And Martin Luther King was a person who talked about boycotts. Cesar Chavez talked about boycotts, and there was a huge grape and lettuce boycott when I was in college and a young person. So I think today it's Amazon. Today
it's a challenging. It's a challenging time.
It's only 2 days.
It's a challenging time
Rachel,
for
thank you
workers.
For the
thank you, Rachel. Marjorie, with unions lacking in power and so many. I mean, I just remember my dad was a Teamster. My mom was a shop steward. And somehow they were able to coexist with Jimmy Hoffa and Robert Kennedy Jr. and being like lionized in my household. But there is a part of capitalism that we don't really pay that much attention to, and that's the unions and workers, right?
Well, by the way, our number is 877-301-8970 if you want to weigh in on whether your kid is at capitalist camp or just staying home and watching TV and playing video games all day long. But I think that's one of the great ironies is that the middle class, when the middle class was doing better, the tax rate was much different than it is now. Wealthy people were paying a lot more money, and unions were strong so that dad could have a job, and mom sometimes didn't even need to work,
right.
And you could actually have a house and have a car. Let's go to Donna in the car. Hi, Donna.
Hi, ladies. Good afternoon to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
So I want to skip.
Oh, Donna, you're breaking up.
Spoiled.
What'd you say, Donna?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
I want to give... Oh, good. You got me now?
Yep.
Good. I want to give a plug for a book called The Opposite of Spoiled. And I think, Marjorie, you and Jim might have spoken about it a number of years ago. Basically, it has you teach your kids. You give them an allowance based on their age. And you put this in envelopes or jars, whatever. And one is for donate. One is for spend. And one is for save. And I've been doing this now. My kids are 15 and 11, been doing it for 5 years. And it is fascinating to watch your children sort of understand the concept, because you can't spend anything in your spend envelope until your save envelope has gotten to a certain point. So my son is like, I want to, you know, buy this Xbox game or whatever. And he's like, look, I have all this money in spend. I'm like, what is in save? Save is your rent. Save is your electric bill. You have to understand, you have to save this money aside for necessities. Meanwhile, my daughter throws everything into donate because she wants to save all the dogs in the world.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that's a great exercise.
I should try that. I should do that for myself, I think, actually.
Yeah. I did that for a week or two when my kids were little, and then I kind of gave up. Yeah. I should have kept going.
It's parenting is
Donna,
hard.
Donna, thank you. That's a great – and we did talk about that, that there was a book that somebody wrote about that, certain amount for savings, certain amount for donations, and certain amount
But the other thing, the hard thing about doing that is that we have to do it ourselves. You know, it's great to impart these values to our kids, but, you know, I don't know about you, but there's a lot of things that I'm not very good at.
Yeah, well, I don't know how much imparting. I hope I imparted some good stuff. Too late now if I didn't. Matthew from Austin, let's go. What do you think?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Marjorie. I've been listening to the show for about a year and a half.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Yeah. So I was just thinking, they can have their you know, capitalism camp, but I want to send my kids to union organizing. You know?
Very good.
I mean, there's more of us than there are of them, so might as well have a couple of camps teaching them how to be good members of the labor movement.
Yeah. Too bad Jim isn't here today, because that's what Jim began his career as a union organizer,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And he was very successful organizing. And, you know, Massachusetts, we have, well, I'm railing against the teachers union all the time, but I'll give this to the teachers union. They are powerful. They take care of their members. We have a lot of very powerful public employee unions in Massachusetts. And a lot of us who are getting older are rethinking the whole.
I had a family member recently ask me about my pension. I said, what makes you think I have a pension? Because everybody in my family is either, you know, a government employee
me
or a
too.
City employee. And I'm like, I don't have a pension. Yeah. How come you don't have a pension? Because I don't want, you know, absolutely.
Yeah.
You're right, Matthew. We're going to put you in charge of that.
Yeah, Matthew, that's a great
Thanks
idea.
For calling
Union
in, Matthew.
Organizer camp, you know. You don't necessarily have to wind up like Jimmy Hoffa. You could do it like the up-and-up sort of way, the Jim Browdy kind of way.
That's right. All right, Marjorie.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me here today. I appreciate
it. I loved it every second.
Do you want to read the goodbye?
No, you can read the goodbye.
Okay, all right. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Also, you can get us on the podcast or iTunes anytime. Tomorrow, live at the GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, Trenny Kuznarek, Rachel Rollins, district attorney, and immigration expert Ally Nourani. Thanks to our crew today, Chelsea, Arjun, Zoe, Hannah, and the engineer, John the Claw. Thanks for listening. I hope to be back soon.
Oh, you will be back soon. Absolutely. And And Jim Brad will be back tomorrow. I always joke that when Jim's not here, he's slithering around somewhere. So I'm sure he's slithering somewhere, and it's an undisclosed location. But thank you very much, Sue O'Connell.
Thank you.
For
it's been
in.
A blast, Marjorie.
I'm Marjorie Egan. She's Sue O'Connell. Jim Brad will be back tomorrow. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in tomorrow or come stop by and say hello at the Boston Public Library. It'll be there 11 to 2. You've been listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Have a great afternoon.